This episode, Once Upon an Uncanny X-Men. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we're finding our joy discussing our love for those mighty mutants from Marvel, the X-Men. Now, we're energized by the recent X-Men 97 cartoon, and we thought we would dive into some uncanny X-Men comics which tie into that recent series. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host. And I may be the best there is at what I do, bub, but what I do isn't very nice. So I brought along a buddy to help me cover these issues. My guest today comes to us all the way from Muir Island in Scotland. He's been a comics blogger, he's a geek fitness enthusiast, and seriously, this guy is so insanely flexible that even Morph is jealous of him. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Mr. Matt Ev. How you doing, buddy?
I'm great, thanks, Shag. Thank you for having me. This is a very, very exciting for me. I can't believe I said that, but yeah, it genuinely is.
Well, we've been chatting about X-Men, God, for years, just very, you know, whether it's private messages or just over in comics threads and things like that. So I knew when I was ready to talk X-Men that, okay, you're the guy I want to do this with first. I think I'm probably going to end up doing lots of X-Men episodes, especially after I vomited words all over my prep document. I just couldn't stop. So clearly I have a lot to say about those mutants. So, but anyway,
I'm not alone in that either.
I was watching him actually add stuff to the Google Doc, and it just kept coming and kept coming and kept coming.
Strap in, folks.
Well, you suggested the issues for today, because I felt a little overwhelmed trying to think about, all right, we know we want to talk a little about X-Men 97, but we want to talk about some classic X-Men comics, really. They sort of tie into it, and I felt kind of overwhelmed because there's so many storylines X-Men 97 touch on. And then you suggested this brilliant idea of talking about the very first Genosha story. So Uncanny X-Men 235 through 238. This is exciting. Did you read these off the stands?
I did, yes. And one of the reasons I wanted to look at these was because I think they're kind of an overlooked period. This arc gets sandwiched between the Brood, the Second Coming of the Brood, and Inferno, and it kind of gets a little lost. And at the time, I wasn't hugely thrilled with it, but so I wanted to give it a reappraisal. But obviously, it's gone on to have a lot more resonance because Genosha keeps coming back and played a massive part in X-Men 97. So I thought it was timely to take another look.
Well, I'm glad you suggested, because other than looking at the covers, I had no memory of this storyline going in whatsoever. Like, you know, we'll get to our X-Men history in a minute, but like, I've read something like 500 plus X-Men comics over the number of years, and it's been, you know, 30 years since I read these. So a lot of my X-Men reading is just kind of a blur. You know, I remember the broad brushstrokes. So this one was just kind of a empty spot for me. So I'm so glad we got a chance to reread it, because it's really enjoyable.
Yeah, likewise, I'd forgotten a lot of this. There are certain key scenes that really imprinted themselves on my memory that we'll get to. But yeah, for the most part, I had a vague sense of where the story went.
Yeah.
So really good to dive back in. And the story that came before this, the Brood story, was my first instinct was to go, let's do that one. I don't know if you recall that, but that was great. The Second Coming of the Brood.
Well, I immediately went, for whatever reason, I wanted to do Fall of the Mutants, because I felt like there was a nod to that in the X-Men 97 cartoon as well. And by the way, we should say this, folks. We're going to spoil the heck out of the X-Men 97 cartoon. I mean, this isn't going to be an hour-long discussion on the series. We can't help but touch on stuff that we read here that influences that. So if you haven't watched X-Men 97, highly encourage it. It's incredible. Like, for me, I didn't really enjoy the original X-Men cartoon that much. Like, I watched it off and on, mainly because, like, oh, look, who's this character appearing this week? But it didn't grab me. This series is a whole other thing. Now, again, we're going to talk more about it in a minute. Yeah, so just be ready for the spoilers, folks. So, Matt, I got to ask you, what is your personal origin story with the X-Men? How did you discover the team, or, you know, what made you fall in love with them? Or the franchise entirely? I mean, it's more than just a team. It's a franchise, really.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, strap in. So this is all tied in with my very earliest memories of comics. So then a lot of that gets very murky in terms of what came first, what came second. So two of the most pivotal X-Men recollections. There was a 1981 hardback reprint called Marvel Presents the X-Men Collector's Edition. And this reprinted issues 56 to 59. So it's the Roy Thomas, Neil Adams run.
Ooh, good stuff.
It wasn't even my book. My friend who lived nearby had it, and I borrowed it from him and read it 1,000 times, and I've since obtained it myself as well. but that is incredible stuff. It's a Sentinel storyline. It's also the Living Monolith, and the art is just incredible from Neil Adams there. So that was kind of one of my first exposures. But at the same time, I think roughly around the same period, there was a British reprint comic called Mighty World of Marvel, which had been around in the 70s, but then had this sort of glossy relaunch in 1983, number one came out. And the first issue of that reprints Uncanny X-Men 141, which is the first issue of Days of Future Past. So that is a very strange first issue of X-Men. It's like, what the hell? You know.
Well, isn't every first, like, I think everybody's first issue of X-Men is like jumping in deep. I feel like there's not a lot of good introductory points that aren't, you know, heads first.
Absolutely. I've always liked that sense of being thrust headfirst into something and not knowing what the hell is going on and trying to figure it out. And 141 is a great example of that because it's set in the future. Everyone's already dead. or if they're not already dead, they die in that issue or in the subsequent one. But yeah, I was just so intrigued by the whole thing. Absolutely loved it. And one of the strange things about that particular comic is the printing is awful. The color reproduction is really off, and like all the colors are a couple of millimeters to the left of where they should be.
Oh gosh, yeah, I remember those days.
Yeah, really badly printed. But I've read it so many times that when I read the actual issues, they look wrong to me. But yes, I have this right next to me here. It's a beautiful thing. So the Neil Adams collection and the 141 came around at roughly the same time. And I was just confused by how both of these things were the X-Men. Compounding this a little more is another of my earliest comics was Avengers 162, which is the one part of the Ultron saga. And on the first page of that, we have Beast, who is dead.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well,
seemingly dead. But in that one, he's blue and furry, whereas in the X-Men Neil Adams stuff, he's human. So like, how are these the same character? What is going on? None of this makes any sense. And obviously I'm reading all of this stuff out of order. And as I say, all this confusion just gets its hooks into me. And I was X-Men for life from that point on, I think.
So when did you start collecting the actual X-Men book?
So I think the first issue I bought off the stands was 206.
Okay. Not too far off from when I started.
Yeah, X-Men versus Freedom Force. But also before then, I'd started buying Secret Wars, which I know was your big entry point as well.
Yes, it was.
And I think it was the same issue, too.
Did you start with issue number 2?
I did.
Oh, my gosh! Now, just to be clear, folks, I'm not talking about Secret Wars 2. I'm talking about the original Secret Wars, issue number 2.
Yes. So, again, this was in the British reprints. But issue 2 was the first one I got.
Okay.
It took me a long time to find issue 1 after that. So, yeah, so the X-Men got me into comics more generally, but Secret Wars dragged me into the Marvel Universe, I think. And then when Secret Wars 2 came around, the British reprints of that, it went through for about 60 issues, I think. Mm-hmm. So it reprinted all the auxiliary material from Secret Wars. So there's a lot of single X-Men issues in there too. So, yeah, so I was drawn in by that. But yeah, 206 was my first one, I think. And yes, I just kept buying off the stand from then until Claremont's departure, basically.
So I'll go ahead and share some of my origins since you mentioned Secret Wars issue number 2. Because yes, that was my entry point to the X-Men. I've told the story before, so I won't go into a lot of details. But I got bullied at school for not knowing Marvel superhero characters, which is insane to think of nowadays. But anyway.
Totally the wrong way around.
Although nowadays, Marvel's so popular, I guess maybe kids do get bullied if they don't know who Iron Man is. I don't know. Anyway, so I didn't know who Ultron was, so I got made fun of at school. So I went out and bought Secret Wars number 2. And, you know, Secret Wars number 3. And so I kept collecting from then on. And of course, Secret Wars number 3 is a huge spotlight for the X-Men. And the only piece of this that's a little confusing for me is I also remember Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, the episode with the X-Men. And that actually came out about 6 months before Secret Wars number 2. So I don't know which I saw first. I may have saw it in reruns afterwards. I don't know. So, but as far as I'm concerned, it's Secret Wars issue 2. And I remember comics were obviously huge in my little subgroup of friends. And I remember riding the school bus home every day and my friends just regaling me with the X-Men stories. I mean, they talked about these things as if they were legends, like mythology. You know, I heard about the Dark Phoenix saga and the Morlocks and Storm losing her powers, you know, all the stuff from like the 170s, 180s, that kind of era. These kids talked about as if it was, you know, real literature. So I was reading about him in Secret Wars, finally put my foot in because I was a little daunted by it because I didn't know where to start. But when Secret Wars 2 came came out and they had that X-Men crossover, issue 196, that was when I bought it, the Secret Wars 2 crossover. And let me tell you, that is an amazing issue to deal with. Rachel is turned into a hound, but really the real key is this, is Kitty Pryde is dealing with all kinds of racism issues against mutants, and she compares it to how racism that exists in a real world. I mean, it's incredibly powerful stuff that the X-Men are so good at tackling, you know?
Yeah. There's some notorious dialogue in that as well, which I won't repeat here, which sits a little awkwardly now, but you know, it's made a point really strongly.
It really did. So in fact, I got a chance to talk about that issue it wasn't recently, it's probably several years ago now, but when I was a guest on the Marvel Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, and we talked about that controversial stuff in that comic. So from there, I bought a bunch of back issues, you know, the previous dozen or so, and then I started with Classic X-Men number one to fill in the gaps. Basically, you know, I owned, I don't know, like 183 forward, and I bought Classic X-Men starting at number one, which was reprinting, you know, giant size X-Men number one, and I kept buying Classic X-Men until it filled in all the missing issues. Now, you were a Classic X-Men guy as well, right?
Yeah, I got that off the shelf as well. So I was buying Uncanny at the same time, and then Classic X-Men started, and I was buying both concurrently, which was, it's the happiest time of my comics life.
Yeah, right? I know! It was so good! I used to have this trading card series of the X-Men covers, and I would put these little, I'd put them in the nine pocket sleeves, and I put little stickers on there, being like, okay, this is Uncanny X-Men, you know, whatever, 94, so this is Classic X-Men number 2. So I'd like, you know, I'd have the cover there, and I'd know what Classic X-Men issue to reference. And I was such a nerd!
Oh, that's great. And those Classic X-Men issues as well, they were great, because they not only reprinted all those amazing stories from that period, but had the Art Adams covers, you had the John Bolton backups, which those Bolton backups, I liked them at the time, but I really appreciate them a lot more now. They're really in-depth, beautiful character pieces.
Oh yeah, and they're like DVD extras. I mean, they're amazing. Yeah. So, and here's something that blew my mind. Maybe everyone knew this but me, I don't know. I learned this from Michelle Fife, that Classic X-Men, it wasn't just reprinting the old stories. Claremont was going back, rewriting bits of it, and they were slicing in new bits of art that
you see new panels from Bolton in there, and
I had forgotten or just didn't realize it at the time. I don't know. So now I want to go back and reread Classic X-Men rather than the original X-Men reprints because I love Claremont being overly wordy. So
yeah, who doesn't?
Right.
But also that cover image from Classic X-Men number one is the X-Men pinup, as far as I'm concerned.
Agreed. Agreed.
Art Adams. Amazing stuff.
I think they used it in X-Men 97, didn't they? Like there were a lot of like quote unquote photographs they would show in X-Men 97 or memories that were actually old comic covers. And I think Classic X-Men number one. Well, there's two Art Adams images that are very similar. Classic X-Men number one, and there's another one which was a promo image, and I don't know which one it was, but I'm pretty sure one of those was there.
I think Classic X-Men number one was in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So good. Now I stuck with it for 10 years, so I went all the way to Uncanny X-Men 320, which was like just after the Phalanx Covenant. So essentially, I read 20 years worth of X-Men comics in 10 years. So I starting with Giant Size X-Men number one, and then whether it be originals or reprints, I read all the way through Phalanx Covenant. So how long did you stick with it?
Not that long. I left shortly after Claremont did. So it was roughly around issue 7 or 8 of the Adjectiveless series.
Okay.
And the strange thing about that was that I didn't realize Claremont had left.
Oh.
Because at that time, I didn't pay a lot of attention to creator credits, especially not writer credits. Mm-hmm. I was always into artists. Writers, not so much. It took me a long time to sort of gravitate towards writers. But yes, but I didn't realize he'd gone because there was no fanfare about it. There was no sort of, this is Chris Claremont's last issue. And I just sensed that something was off with the book, and I just started to dislike it.
Sure.
And so I thought, right, this isn't for me anymore. Yeah, so it was only later that I discovered that he left, and suddenly everything made sense as to why there'd been this seeming decline.
Okay.
So I left X-Men at that point, and I left Marvel at that point, and I started to turn away from comics generally until I found Justice League, as we've discussed elsewhere.
Oh, the Bwahaha Justice League?
Indeed, yeah.
Excellent choice, sir. Excellent choice. If only someone would do a podcast about that.
Indeed, someone should do that. Someone should not stop doing that.
Oh!
but I discussed that elsewhere. That was my sort of DC origin, because I'd never read DC before then. And then I stayed on the DC side of the fence and only came back to Marvel when Grant Morrison started on New X-Men. So my Marvel reading has always been X-Men based. essentially.
Interesting. So my reading started off at Marvel, you know, with Secret Wars and X-Men and, oh gosh, Power Pack and some Marvel team-ups and Iron Man, a bunch of different Marvel books. And then, like you, I gravitated to DC and didn't look back for a long time. And it wasn't until, I don't know, at some point I realized I could love both. And then I went through lots of phases where I'd read more of one, more of the other. There's a kind of a grass is greener kind of thing. Like, you know, when Infinite Crisis and that kind of stuff was going on, I didn't like the direction DC was going. I was like, oh, look, Bendis Avengers looks a lot more pretty than this. So I, you know, went back to Marvel. So I've come back to the X-Men a lot over the years. But I will say, I should mention, through that 10-year period that I read X-Men, again, 20 years worth of books in 10 years, I added it up. It's close to like 500 X-Men books I bought during that time. Between X-Men, you know, Uncanny X-Men, New Mutants, X-Factor, X-Force, Excalibur, you know, whatever, Obnoxio the Clown, X-Men versus the Micronauts, you know, whatever. And so I hadn't really thought about it. I guess it was my biggest fandom for a long, long, long time. So let's talk about, real briefly, just rapid fire, some of the stuff we've read since then that we enjoy. Obviously, Grant Morrison, I've podcasted enough with you to know you're a Morrison devotee. But for me, I'll just throw a couple out there. The X-Men Forever series was something that I fell in love with. So what happens is, it's sort of like X-Men 97. The way this book is Claremont came back and did essentially a parallel universe, I guess. And the theory of this book was basically, what if Claremont hadn't left the X-Men? So the period you just said where it declined, just pretend that never happened and pretend Claremont kept going. And it was drawn by Tom Grummett, who's one of my favorite artists. He's sort of like a 1990s, 2000s version of John Byrne. He can draw anyone and it looks great, but you always immediately recognize his style. So to me, that's sort of like a modern John Byrne sort of thing. So I loved X-Men Forever, thought that was great. I read Bendis's All New X-Men, which was like the original X-Men came back to the present. Amazing X-Men, because it had lots of Nightcrawler. So those are just some of the eras I've read since then. What about you?
I've never read the X-Men Forever, and I think I probably should.
It's fun.
Yeah, I was thinking for a moment you meant the X-Men The Hidden Years that Byrne did, which was not good. But
Oh, really? Okay, see, I haven't reread it since it came out. So I have fond memories of it, but that's because I read it at the time. All right.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, I was going to say I've not read X-Men Forever because you can't go back, you know, once Claremont left. But then having said that, he did return to X-Men with Alan Davis, and that's quite a good run. So okay. I'd recommend that one. New X-Men I really enjoyed when it started. Although this is kind of a recurring thing for me, I'm very art sensitive, so absolutely love Frank Quitely's art. But at some point when the art started to decline on that title, I started to lose interest. So I've never actually finished New X-Men. I don't think.
And is that just for clarification? That's the Morrison run.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
So the combination of Quitely and Morrison is kind of comics dream team, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
But yes, if I can't get with the art, I can't finish a book. So I know some people can just sort of power on through art they're not into. To me, that's kind of at the forefront. So that needs to be there for me to be engaged with it.
So I'm going to call you on the carpet, sir. Mm-hmm. Chaz Truog and Animal Man. I mean, you got through that. I know you did.
Yeah, I don't dislike his work, though. I don't think it's amazing, but it's not like it puts me off. But there are certain artists who I can't look at their work.
All right.
So I don't know if I should name names, but...
No, let's not do that. No, it's not.
Greg Land!
Oh, okay. All right.
But then Astonishing X-Men I absolutely loved as well. Sort of controversies about the creator notwithstanding. But that was a real return to form for X-Men for me. It's some of the most amazing Cyclops work in there. And
not endorsing the creator here, but just for the people at home. That's the Joss Whedon and John Cassidy or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Gotcha.
So superb artwork. It brought Colossus back. Amazing Cyclops moments. And brought Emma Frost to the forefront. Yes, that's a great comic. So did you ever read that?
I have not, actually. I think the closest I got was back when they were experimenting with motion comics online. I don't know if you remember those. I know, right. They're horrible, and thank goodness they went away. But I think I read one of those like online in the early 2000s or something. So that's about the closest I got to it. But, I mean, the art and, again, the creator notwithstanding, I love some of the stuff he's written. So it's something I might check out.
Yeah, I would recommend. And it's only, 25 issues in total, something like that? So,
okay.
Yeah, won't take long.
Well, if you try out X-Men Forever, just strap yourself in, because Claremont, he takes that point from like 1992 when he leaves the series, and he's unencumbered by editorial. So he does things And I don't mean that in a bad way, but like he does very non-commercial things with the characters. Stuff that an editor would be like, no, you can't do that to the character. They're on t-shirts. They're on lunchboxes. So that's nice that he has the full creativity power to do whatever he wants. So some really interesting stuff. I don't want to say I'm on the air, but he did some really interesting stuff with the characters. Where you're like, wow, I never thought they would do that. And it's interesting. You're like, oh, it kind of works. So I, Tom Grummett. It's worth having the Tom Grummett art alone.
Excellent. I will check that out, definitely. Thank you for the recommendation.
So we got to ask, the one thing we didn't answer is why? Why do we love the X-Men? For me, it's hard to pin down. Like, I just fell in love. You know, I think for me, the best way I can say, I think, is that it's because it's an underdog story. You know, they're battling against oppression. They're battling against racism. You know, there's always great action. There's always amazing art. You know, the writing, again, I'm a sucker for Claremont's brand of overwriting. So the Claremont era of X-Men just feels comfortable to me. I don't know. Are you able to pin down why you love them?
Similar, really. I mean, it's the underdog thing. I mean, both of those really early experiences that I had with X-Men were them being hunted by Sentinels, basically.
So, yeah, there you go.
So they're always kind of the outsiders and the oppressed. And also, there's always been this kind of chaotic energy to the book that you don't get from something like, say, Justice League, where, you know, they're constantly there. The status quo is always in flux. So, you know, the members in terms of the lineup, in terms of their status, in terms of where they're based, even. I mean, we'll get to this later, but there's a huge swathe of X-Men where there is no status quo. It's just sort of chaos for about 30 issues after the period we're discussing today. And that's just a really bold direction to take a book, I think, where they sort of lose the central concept. And they're just, well, they're mutable. To use an appropriate term, you know, you can do a lot with the X-Men and still have them be the X-Men. So I think that's quite interesting about them. And also I like the fact that, you know, often the powers and things come with a price. So you have Cyclops is a great example of that. You've got Nightcrawler, who can't fit in with ordinary society. You've got Rogue. So there is this, it's not just a gift. They're not sort of amazing abilities bestowed without any cost. I think that makes them quite interesting as well. And that leads to a lot of drama and soap opera and hand-wringing and angst, which really I related to as a teenager.
Sure. And that's a great point about the powers. DC's famous for having, you know, gigantic icons that, you know, live on pedestals, gods that live on pedestals. Mm-hmm. And yeah, with this X-Men, it was a burden for a lot of them. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I couldn't relate to kind of Superman or Captain America, these sort of paragons of virtue and you know, they're impeccable and perfect, but the X-Men were weirdos and outsiders, and that kind of spoke to me. So, although, you know, being an outsider is all relative, and I think with hindsight, I realized I was just a, you know, an ordinary teenager. But at the time, you feel alienated from the world, and that's why the X-Men come in.
And that every teenager feels that way. Every teenager does, exactly. So, and us as geeks, in a lot of ways, we were outsiders too. Even though there was clearly a bunch at my school enough to bully me, it was still, we felt like outsiders.
Yeah, there were not that many at my school, so we had a small select group of friends who were into comics, but yeah, it was not at all a mainstream thing as it is now. So. But another thing I really loved about X-Men, as I said, I really drawn to art. Art is kind of predominant for me in my comics, and X-Men always had great art. So my first exposure was Byrne on the one hand, Neil Adams on the other. And then when I started buying it off the shelves, it was John Romita Jr. And then we moved on to Mark Silvestri. There was Barry Windsor Smith. You had Art Adams doing classic X-Men covers. You had John Bolton doing the backups. You had Alan Davis popping in from time to time. You had, who else? Walt Simonson over on X-Factor, Sienkiewicz on New Mutants, the Wolverine series, the Frank Miller. It was just all good all the time. There were some artists I liked less than others, which again we'll get to. But this continued to this day as well. So we had Frank Quitely, John Cassaday, Stuart Immonen, Pepe Larraz on the recent Krakoa stuff, Russell Doughton as well on Marauders, which is a great book. So yeah, they seem to have really strong lineup with artists with the X-Men.
Oh, it's amazing the consistency of, well, I shouldn't say, because there are some bad periods, especially in the 90s, but the number, the volume of amazing artists they've had is just unbelievable. And part of it's because it was such a big selling book, but man, the art's amazing. And I'm glad you mentioned Art Adams. We're going to put a pin in that in just a minute, because I'm going to come back to Art Adams when we get to our in-stock trades picks, because he is one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some favorite eras and of the X-Men comics or characters. So you go first. Let's do rapid fire, because we're already 30 minutes into the show, so go rapid fire.
Favorite era, I mean, broadly speaking, it's the entire Claremont era, but within that, from the moment John Byrne started, I like the Cochrane stuff before that, but I think the book doesn't really kick off until Byrne's arrival.
Mm-hmm.
Every Byrne issue I absolutely adore, like from start to finish. After that, the Paul Smith run is really good, all the Romita stuff, and then up into the 2000s around Mutant Massacre, right into Fall of the Mutants, and then the Outback era. Oh, the Outback era. I love the Outback era, and I love the lineup in the Outback era, despite the fact that several of my favorite members are absent from the team. It's sort of perfectly balanced, and there's something really unique and strange about that era that really appeals to me.
It feels a little bit like Justice League International, not in the funniness, but just, it's like, who are these people? You know, because the Justice League is like, these aren't the Justice League. It's like, here's like, these aren't the X-Men, you know, but they were at the time, and that's what makes it special.
I think the sort of the emblematic star of that is Longshot as well, who has no business being on an X-Men team because he's not even a mutant for starters. But yes, his solo series was great. Again, Art Adams. But yeah, the fact that they chose to bring in this really strange character who really shouldn't be there and really is not on the same power level as the rest of the team, or, you know, he doesn't even have much of a personality because he's kind of a blank slate.
Mm-hmm.
But it somehow just all works. And yeah, Claremont has a way of making this dysfunctional group work together. And there's some great stories in that era, especially the annuals in that era as well.
It's, and I don't know if maybe we're going to talk about it more later, but like it's actually, for me, it feels like a lost era. Like it felt very directionless. And I think maybe Claremont was struggling as far as writer's block. I don't know. I've tried to find some interviews on it and I haven't been able to stumble across them yet. But it felt like it was like he didn't have his big mapped out plan like he normally would have. But at the same time, I love it for that. And that was a big part of, you know, falling in love with the X-Men and falling deeper in love with the X-Men. Is like, oh, take him away from the mansion, put him in some weird place, give him, you know, a guy with a bull thrower to teleport them. I mean, it changed up the entire dynamic, and I found that fascinating.
Yeah, it felt like anything could happen, and frequently did,
because
there was no status quo anymore, and that went on for such a long time as well. It was about 40 more issues before the team got back together, which is crazy, really, but...
Yeah. So I was shocked that you didn't put Grant Morrison on your list. I know you're a huge Morrison devotee, so I was was that not your... Obviously, you said the art trailed off, so but it was not...
Yeah, so I trailed off the book as the art started to push me away.
Okay,
But the beginning of that that run is fantastic, yes. And I've loved... I know you're not a huge fan, but I've loved the Krakoa era as well, up to a point where there was just too many books and I don't know what's going on anymore. But the original House of X, Powers of X, that was the biggest shot in the arm X-Men's had in 20, 30 years or so.
And as we're recording this, just this week, the conclusion of the Krakoa story, I think, just came out this week, if I understand correctly.
Indeed, but I'm so behind, I've not got to, I've not picked that up yet.
So I tried to put my foot in the Krakoa series, our era. I read a lot of stuff, and I just couldn't find my footing. And I'm not saying it's bad, it just wasn't for me. Like, for my tastes, the X-Men, you know, leading a nation and being, you know, respected and having all this power, that's not where my X-Men need to be. The underdogs, like, they have to be operating in secret, outcasts, hated by the general public, you know, always on the back foot. So that's more my X-Men. I did read the Free Comic Book Day preview of Gail Simone. She did a little story about Jubilee, and that felt to me, at least, and we'll have to see how it pans out, but Gail Simone's new direction, that may be more where I can get back into X-Men again. I'll have to find out.
I know what you mean about the Krakoa stuff, but I think I kind of see it as an ongoing experiment. It's not going to be the status quo forever.
Right.
Because,
right,
you know, it's X-Men. The other shoe's going to drop. Yep. Cyclops will again have a bad day. So the recurring motif of X-Men is Cyclops will perpetually have a bad day.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's interesting to see how they frame this whole society when they're finally getting on top for the first time ever. So.
And I figure everything resets, right? You know, I mean, Spider-Man's identity was public and, you know, all these different things happen that are big sea changes for the character. And then they find a way to pretty much move it back to the iconic status. So I figure that's where we're going to end up. And then that's fine. And it's comics, you know, whatever. For me, there are lots of different eras I love, but mostly the team that's like my X-Men is like around Uncanny X-Men 200, Mutant Massacre, that kind of era, you know, Magneto's leading the team. Professor X is nowhere to be seen. They're definitely being hunted. They're definitely on the run. They're being beaten down. Kitty's there. I mean, that's kind of who I love for the X-Men. I love lots of other stuff, but that's my default probably.
So yeah, speaking my language there, although Kitty's not there for most of that. Kitty was absent from the X-Men for 15 years.
Well, true. Well, that wasn't until after Mutant Massacre, though.
Yeah. So she's there for the early part of that and then doesn't come back till, I think, 2001, something like that, which is a crazy long time.
So if you were actually listening to what I said then,
Sorry.
I said up until Mutant Massacre, because I need Kitty and Nightcrawler on my team. Like, that's important to me. And I realize they go off to Excalibur and all that. So anyway, just had to take a shot at you, sir.
I appreciate it.
And
taking down a peg or two.
And speaking of appreciation, while I appreciate Byrne, I don't have the same overwhelming nostalgia as most fans do. Like, I love it. It's beautiful to look at. But I didn't read the Byrne stuff till much, much later because I was already, you know, already buying John Romita Jr. I was following through X-Men Classics, so it took me a long time to get to the Byrne era. So by the time I read it, I enjoyed it. But it was not where my foundation was, I guess I should say.
I think part of that Byrne affection as well for me comes from Ahotmu.
Sure.
A lot of the panels in Ahotmu are taken from Byrne era comics, both Fantastic Four and X-Men and all sorts of things. So they were already kind of burned in my brain by the time I got around to actually seeing them in classic X-Men.
Sure. So burned already, in your brain.
Yeah. Already kind of definitive by that point. So.
And I don't want to put myself out there wrong. Like, I love his artwork. I genuinely will buy pretty much anything Byrne from the 80s. It's just going to be a win. But it just, those particular X-Men issues aren't imprinted on me in the same way as others. Now, the early New Mutants, those are imprinted on me. Now, I didn't read them as they were coming out. I read them as back issues. But like those first, I don't know, 30, 40 issues of New Mutants just fill me with so much joy. Whether it's the early stuff that feels a little clumsy, you know, up until Sienkiewicz comes in. And then the Sienkiewicz stuff just blows you away. You know, Ilyana... I used to work at a comic shop for years, and it just closed, actually, in the last couple of weeks. It'd been open for 35 years or whatever. They got hit by a tornado. He had to close. It's very sad. In fact, you can go out and check out. I've been promoting the GoFundMe if you want. But the owner and I have been friends all this time, and he had this wooden standee that he made, like, in the 80s of Ilyana. She's, like, it's 5 foot tall, you know, cut out of wood and painted of Ilyana, and he gave it to me. So it's sitting in my house now, and my wife's kind of like, why is this here? You know, and, of course, I don't dare tell her that, you know, she's this demonic, you know, teenager girl that we all had a crush on when we were teenagers ourselves. So it's I'm happy to have it, but I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
That is very cool. One of my geeky friends from when I was a teenager, he's kind of my oldest friend in the world. And I always used to joke when we were kids that if I ever had a daughter, I'd name her Ilyana. And I didn't do that in the end, but he did.
No way.
He did.
Oh, wow. Now, see, given that I had such a crush on Ilyana, that's a little creepy to me. But anyway. All right, so rapid fire favorite characters from the X-Men. Go.
Oh, my God. Well, when I was a kid, Wolverine, 100% Wolverine. In fact, yeah, the thing about Secret Wars and Issue 2. So the Secret Wars Issue 2 was a reprint, and it had a different cover. So a lot of the British reprints had different covers to the American ones. And Wolverine was front and center on the issue 2 of Secret Wars.
Nice.
So he was there, claws out, saying, let's do it to them before they do it to us or something. So to a 10-year-old or however old I was, that was very pivotal. Yep, so... Wolverine was big for me. Overexposed during the 90s, went off him.
You think?
Have that sort of, always have that sort of base level affection for Wolverine, I think. Although I hate the bone claws. There weren't any bone claws. It never happened.
Okay.
Never, ever happened. So we don't need to discuss that. It's great. Apart from that, Colossus. I love Colossus. It's that whole thing where he's an artist, this really sensitive soul, but in this massive, indestructible body. I like the dichotomy of that. I like Beast. He's got this verbose vocabulary, but also very physical as well. And in my physical activities, I do take some inspiration from him and like to hurl myself about the place. Yeah, also loads of them. Rogue, Nightcrawler, Cyclops, Psylocke, but it has to be British Psylocke, not Ninja Psylocke.
Okay.
I kind of felt they that was a misstep. I've never really liked the Asian version of Psylocke there. We'll get on to Psylocke later, I think, to discuss these issues. But
okay.
And then from New Mutants, got Warlocke was a particular favourite, Danny. I always liked Kitty, Storm, but specifically Powerless Storm.
Oh, I can see that, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, she was kind of powerless when I first came onto the book, and I always liked that idea that she has no powers yet, can run the team, and was complete badass during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's something about weather powers have always irked me, I don't know why.
Okay. A little strange to hang up on,
yeah,
but okay.
I know. It's just one of those things. And recently, just Emma Frost has been really a massively beneficial addition to the X-Men lineup. I think she's better as this sort of imperious presence within the team rather than as an antagonist. So
okay. She's
really great in Astonishing X-Men. She's been great in the Krakoa era. You can never quite trust her, but she's generally doing the right thing, but more or less.
Interesting. Okay.
And also, I think X-Men have a really great rogues gallery there too, sort of kind of up there with Spider-Man's and Batman's rogue galleries.
Well, I got to say, the X-Men rogue gallery is, it's unique to them, and that I think it works because the villains feel like reflections of them. You know, like Magneto is a tortured soul. Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? He's kind of both sometimes. And I love that about the X-Men bad guys, is they're just as complicated as the X-Men characters.
Yeah. And like I say, the Hellfire Club. So Emma Frost used to be part of that. She's on the team. So there's always been that moral ambiguity. There's been a lot of stuff in the Krakoa era featuring Sebastian Shaw in the Marauders book. He's been a really fascinating presence during that. So I like the way they take these kind of villains that could have been one-off antagonists and then sort of find a way to draw complexity out of them later.
It's funny when you mention Sebastian Shaw, I'm like, isn't he dead? And then I realized I'm talking about the X-Men. So, like...
Nobody dies at the moment. Well, he suffered some horrible fates, but was left alive in Marauders. So okay. Let's leave it at that. Leave it at that.
So for me, some of my favorites are, and probably this one was the biggest shock to me, is Cyclops. And I realized a lot has happened to him in the books, and a lot of people don't like him anymore, or maybe they never liked him. I don't know. Maybe I'm just oblivious. But I didn't realize it until I was reading X-Factor, which didn't even have Cyclops in it, but it was the Peter David era of X-Factor, and Havok, as his brother, crystallized the whole thing for me in that psychologist issue, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. So, because when I was younger, I felt a little bit like Havok. Like, I felt this need to live up to my brother's image. Now, there was no animosity between me and my brother. No, I think my brother's great, but he just cast a big shadow. And so growing up, especially in my teen years, I felt like I was trying to live up to my brother. And in a lot of ways, I idolized Cyclops, I idolized my brother. And so Cyclops is a big influence on me. I love the leader kind of character. I love the journey he's been through. Again, I know he's become a dick a lot, but those aren't the issues I read. So
I think Cyclops has always been a fascinating character. I've always liked him. Yeah, he's kind of the main pillar of the team, you know, and he's the embodiment of that idea of having a curse as well as a gift.
Yeah. Well, and he's sort of like Nightwing in that, you know, if Professor X is Batman, you know, and Nightwing goes on to carry on Batman's dream, if you will, that's Cyclops' job. He's to carry on the professor's job, you know, dream. So Kitty Pryde, I love her unrelenting optimism, right? I mean, she's ballsy. She's adorable. You know, she's kind of the reader in the comic or the fantasy girlfriend of the reader, depending on how you look at it. So she's there for us. And it always bothered me that Jubilee replaced her, essentially, you know, in the popular culture. Like, every time I see a story of Jubilee, I'm like, that should have been Kitty. I think I'm glad they gave her a chance to grow up, though.
Yeah, and again, if you want more Kitty, read Marauders. She's great in that.
Yeah, okay. All right. See, when I started the Krakoa era, the whole point of it was to get to Marauders, but I never got there. Right. I gave up too early. So Nightcrawler's another favorite of mine. Again, I think I like the Optimists. So again, persecuted for his appearance. You know, he's a swashbuckler. Great power usage, especially when you get to see him like in animation or in live action when he starts teleporting around and you're like, oh my gosh, this is better than I thought. You know, and he's funny. And I love the idea of a hero who's very, very religious. And I don't even know why that appeals to me, but just the fact that they have a faith in something that's set in the real world, I think that's great that they have certain characters like that, you know, him and Daredevil both.
And Nightcrawler was at his best in Excalibur, I'd say. And plus, hot take here, but maybe Nightcrawler drawn by Alan Davis is the sexiest character in comics.
Interesting. I gave up on Excalibur way too early, so maybe I need to dive back in, but it felt also rudderless to me for a long time, so maybe I need to go back to it.
Excalibur is one of those, like I've mentioned before, but yes, if Alan Davis is drawing it, I'm all on board. It's some of my favorite comics ever. Anyone else, I have no interest whatsoever.
Another X-Men, and this one is completely unfounded, but I love Banshee, but I don't. I can't point to a single story where I loved him. I just love the idea of the character. I love his look. I love his attitude. I always wish I could see more of him, but there's like, when he's there on the page or on the screen, I'm like, ooh, I am into this, but I can't even tell you like a favorite Banshee story. I just love him. So
I agree. He's great.
Yep. And I could make cases, as I started making my list, I can make cases for so many more characters. I could absolutely sit here and preach about Storm or Rogue. Oh my God, Rogue. Then on the New Mutants, Ilyana, I love Cannonball. Warlock, you know, Colossus, you mentioned him, he's great. Of course, Wolverine. I feel like everyone goes through a Batman era. I also feel like everyone goes through a Wolverine phase. But
100%.
Havoc, you know, even Magneto, I could argue, is a great X-Men character, not even a villain. So anyway.
I think it says a lot about X-Men that I don't have a favorite character. I did as a kid. I've not had one since. It's always been, they're more of a collective to me. And it's the dynamics between them that are interesting rather than I'm gravitating towards this one character, you know?
You know, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that because, you know, like the Justice League or the Avengers are a bunch of popular characters brought together, mm-hmm. whereas the X-Men, it was created as a team and it's mostly stayed a team. I'm sure individual characters have gotten their own series. Other than Wolverine, though, none of them, you know, probably are that independent. They all come out of the X-Men. So the X-Men is more of a unit rather than individual characters.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
All right. Well, we need to get rolling here. So, so let's take a second to thank our sponsors, folks, because I want to delay this even further. This episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we select a comic book collected edition to discuss briefly from the InStockTrades library, and it's usually tied into our discussion in some way, shape, or form. I told you earlier, put a pin in Art Adams. Well, here we go. So my pick is Marvel Monograph Trade Paperback Art of Arthur Adams X-Men. So this is a 112-page collection of amazing Art Adams X-Men art. I could stare at this stuff all day long. You can see some of the sample pages online. It is freaking gorgeous. I bought a lot of Art Adams art books over the years, like the Tomorrow's book, just because I want to look at his pretty pictures. There are so... I bought a sketchbook from him at a convention. Anyway, he is an amazing artist, and his X-Men stuff are some of my absolute favorite. You know, those annuals, the New Mutants special, when the, you know, all of those. Like, when I used to go back and reread X-Men stuff, I would reread the Art Adams stuff. I would specifically go to, like, that Asgard story, you know, with New Mutants and X-Men. Like, I would specifically seek out the Art Adams issues because they, to me, were my favorite way the X-Men should look. And, you know, he's a lot of why the artistic explosion of the 90s happened. So many artists were trying to emulate his style. They didn't do it right. But he was a forerunner for the amazing, you know, level of artistic detail. So anyway, 112 pages, was published in 2020. It's a full color soft cover. Normally goes for $19.99, but you can get it 38% off. So it's only $12.39. Hell of a steal just to get a chance to revisit so many great Art Adams images. So what'd you bring, sir?
Well, just before I reveal that, I have to say I need that book. I need to get that book.
Right?
Yeah, I love Art Adams, especially during that era, and so I'm going to have to buy that. So you've got at least one sale from me.
There we go.
I have brought along the X-Men Epic Collection Dissolution Rebirth. So thinking of the X-Men as this underdog team, and this is the underdogest of underdog eras. So this is from issue 248 of Uncanny to 267, and this is a weird period. Let's not beat about the bush here. This is when Psylocke turns into Asian Psylocke. It's when the Reavers come back and crucify Wolverine. All the mutants go through the Siege Perilous and end up starting new lives. You end up with a really strange team of X-Men consisting of Forge, Sunder, Banshee, Amanda Sefton. Yeah, not A-listers here.
Right.
But yeah, that's why I'm suggesting it. It's an underappreciated era of X-Men. It's deeply strange, deeply weird, deeply messy, and everything I like about X-Men, essentially. So this is written by Chris Claremont with various artists, including, I think, the earliest issues of Jim Lee on X-Men, or around the earliest issues, anyway. And you could normally buy this for $44.99, and the in-stock trades price is $27.89, saving you a whopping 38%.
That's fantastic. And this era, like you said, it's crazy. And this is the stuff stuff I mentioned that feels a little bit rudderless, but it's fascinating to watch it happen. I mean, this is exactly what you want. They are deconstructing the X-Men, because this ends with 267, and you have to deconstruct the X-Men in order to build them back up, which is what you get beginning with issue 281, which is the same era of the launch of the Adjective X-Men number one. Now, that era goes bad very quickly, but in order to build that team, that iconic 1991-1992 team, you've got to tear it all down. And that's what this is. This is the tearing down. Disillusions right there in the name. Really wild, wild, wild stuff. Wolverine being crucified. Holy crap. One of the greatest covers of all time.
Indeed, indeed.
All right, folks, for these and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. This episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying shows on the network, the best way to support these shows is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW Podcast, and consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode, special thanks go out to Michael Salko, David Ace Gutierrez, and Gord Tolton. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. All right, so we want to hear from you. I mean, good Lord, Matt and I have been talking for almost an hour already, and we haven't even got to the subject of today's topic. Yikes! But we want to hear from you guys, too, because we want to hear your favorite X-Men. We want to hear your favorite eras. We want to hear, you know, what you think of X-Men 97. You know, give us your spirited defense of why the X-Men Apocalypse is the best X-Men movie. I almost couldn't say that with a straight face. And the best way to be part of the conversation is in our comments section on our website. So go out there and visit fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Leave your thoughts on the show post for this episode. I will be reading comments from our website on a future episode. I do that every fifth episode of Once Upon a Geek. This happens to be the 22nd episode, so you got a little time. So be sure to leave your comments there. You can also find us on Twitter and Blue Sky as Once Upon a Geek, or on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. All right, Matt, we're going to need to take a quick break. Let's jump through the Siege Perilous, and then when we come back, we are going to cover Uncanny X-Men 235 through 238 and talk about X-Men 97.
I'm scaling this wall just as easily as I can walk. My fingers alone are adhering, supporting me.
The Amazing Spider-Man, created by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, has conquered every medium, from newspaper strips to the silver screen. But he began his life in a pulp periodical destined for cancellation. Let's explore these beginnings together. The Amazing Spider-Man from the very beginning. A brand new podcast on Spotify.
There's some sort of danger here, but what?
It's the year 1992, and the Justice Society of America, the world's first superhero team, make a triumphant return after 6 years trapped in another dimension. Finally home, the JSA find themselves relics in a world that has moved on. It's the age of pulse-pounding action, where the rules of fair play are tossed aside for gritty violence. Our heroes ask themselves, does the world still need a Justice Society? Oh, yes, it does. Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for JSA in the 90s. We'll delve into the 10-issue Justice Society of America ongoing series, drawn by the iconic Mike Parabek. We'll explore the 8-issue retroactive miniseries and unearth hidden gems from the era. Join us for JSA in the 90s, available as part of the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, beginning in August 2024. All right, folks, we are back for hour four of this X-Men podcast. Here we go. We are going to cover Uncanny X-Men, number 235 through 238. And just to sort of set the stage, at this point, the X-Men, you know, we talked a little bit about the Australian era, right? So the world thinks the X-Men are dead, having died during the crossover Fall of the Mutants. And in there, they were saving the world live on TV, so the whole world saw them do it. They saved the world from this mystical bad guy called the Adversary. So they let the world think that they're dead, and the X-Men now operate in hiding from a base in the Australian outback. Additionally, due to some mystical mumbo-jumbo, the X-Men are now invisible to all detection devices and abilities. They are only visible to the naked eye. And at this time, the team is led by Storm, who has her powers, with members including Wolverine, Colossus, Rogue, and here's where it starts to get weird, Havoc, Longshot, Dazzler, and Psylocke. As we said, it's a strange makeup of a team, but hey, these are our X-Men. And the team is aided by Cyclops' estranged wife, Madeline Pryor, as well as the indigenous Australian, a mutant teleporter named Gateway. So these are published by Marvel Comics. It's a four-issue storyline. The cover dates were October through November 1988. It was on the shelves June through July 1988. So this is one of those occasions where they were publishing two issues a month during the summer to get those quarters from us teenagers. So the cover price was $1, and that's four shiny quarters per issue, costing you a total of 16 quarters for this entire storyline. Page count's 22 pages per issue, and the covers alternate. So you get an issue by Mark Silvestri with inks by Dan Green. Then you get a cover by Rick Leonardi. Sometimes with inks by P. Craig Russell, other times with inks by Terry Austin. So, what do you think about these covers, buddy?
I think three of them are okay, and one of them is phenomenal.
Okay, all right. What you got?
So, 236 is, for me, just the obvious standout of these four.
Oh, agreed. Why don't you describe it for the people at home real quick?
So we have two military-looking men standing either side of Rogue and Wolverine, who are suspended by their feet, tied up to some sort of wooden rack. And this is framed as a kind of Polaroid photo.
Mm-hmm.
And written on it is Magistrate 2 Mutants 0. And it's there are bullets scattered around on top of the photo, too.
Yeah, Silvestri knocked this one out of the park, man.
It is phenomenal. Yeah, there's a sort of, the magistrates are smiling there. There's kind of casual cruelty to this. It's like a sort of hunting trophy.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a hunting trophy, yep.
Yeah, and I'm not fond of trophy hunters, so that's really sort of sold me on the the evil of these guys. So.
And now that I've reread the story, this one epitomizes this storyline the best. You know, this one tells you every, like, this from now on when I look at this cover, I'll be able to remember, oh, that's the storyline. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Now, I would say the first one, 235 and 238, are just, they're not generic pinups of the team, but they're kind of, I mean, it's part of the story, but it's just, it's the team in action going to beat up guys, you know, whatever.
They're kind of the same, except the framing is different. So there's both, it's the entire team of X-Men surrounded by people with guns, but on the first issue, they're looking like they're the targets, whereas on the last issue, the X-Men are attacking their attackers.
Oh, that's a good distinction.
They're kind of mirror images of each other.
Yeah. And I don't want to poo-poo them because, I mean, still, it's Rick Leonardi and Mark Silvestri, so it's great. It's just they're not standouts like the other one.
Agreed.
And the 237 is pretty good, too. It's got Wolverine and Rogue holding on for dear life on top of a moving train. And it says, all aboard the mutant train. So I think that one's pretty good. I think Leonardi did a nice job on that one.
Yeah. It looks like a sort of classic adventure comic, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a sort of pulp novel or something, you know?
Yeah, you're right, yeah. And in this case, what you don't know is, as you guys at home, but they were powerless at this point, so them holding onto a moving train is legitimately terrifying. So, all right, so let's talk real quick. As we get into, so obviously it's written by Chris Claremont. I did a little digging, so I'm like, you know, okay, Chris Claremont's writing two issues, you know, during the summer. That's got to be a little bit of extra work for him. Oh my God, the man was trying to kill himself in the summer of 1988. So he not only wrote these two issues of X-Men, right, in June and July, two issues each month. Also, X-Men Annual number 12 came out, which was the Evolutionary War tie-in.
So good.
and so that's another big fat comic he wrote. Then also in June and July, Excalibur number 1 and 2 came out. So he had launch an entirely, I mean, they had already done the one shot, but he had to launch a whole new series as the writer. Also in July, Wolverine number 1 came out that he wrote. So there he's launching two brand new ongoing series that he had to, you know, formulate and craft the same time he's doing the annual and writing the two issues of X-Men. Then, just because I guess he has no life, he was also writing a short story in Marvel Comics Presents at that point. So he was writing a Wolverine story, like whatever they were, like 8 pages or something. So he had 4 of those come out at the same time. And a Marvel Fanfare story he wrote, a 15-page story was in there. Which is absolutely insane. And as we mentioned, at the same time, he was rewriting content for Classic X-Men. So, what a summer. Holy crap.
That's incredible. But, I mean, you can tell he was cutting corners because there's virtually no dialogue in these four issues.
Okay.
That's very much not the case.
Well, I started thinking about the cutting corners thing, though, because there is an issue in here. It feels a little bit like padding. But I mean, it's more of an exploration. We'll get into it in a bit. Oh, anyway,
really?
Sorry.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, it's not, I don't know. All right. So all four issues are written by Chris Claremont. The art is alternating, same as the covers. You got two issues with pencils by Mark Silvestri and Dan Green, two issues with pencils by Rick Leonardi, and then one issue is inked by P. Craig Russell, the other by Terry Austin. Letters by Tom Orzechowski, who, man, you know, Chris Claremont better been paying him extra for the amount of words he had to write on these pages. Colorist is Glenn Wien and Petra Scotzi, and then editor is Bob Harris. So we're going to go issue by issue here. At least we're going to try, and we'll see how this goes. For first up, Uncanny X-Men number 235. So the story kicks off on the island nation of Genosha. As readers, we're following a hunted mutant as he smuggles his baby aboard an airplane bound for Australia, hoping to deliver his son to a free land. Now, while his son escapes, the super strong man is murdered by the Genoshan magistrate military. 2 days later in Australia, a superpowered team of Genoshan agents called the Press Gang ambush a Genoshan expatriate named Jenny Ransom. They're intent on returning her to her home country. Now, when they capture Jenny, they also capture her pilot, a woman by the name of Madeline Pryor. Uh-oh. So the X-Men respond to the mysterious abductions, tracking the Press Gang to a hospital in Sydney. But unfortunately, the hostages, Jenny and Madeline, have already been teleported to the island nation of Genosha. A huge brawl ensues between the X-Men, the Press Gang, and these teams of Genoshan magistrate soldiers, and in the end, the baby from the beginning of the issue is recovered by the Genoshans. And while the X-Men do defeat the magistrate soldiers, unfortunately Wolverine and Rogue are captured and teleported to Genosha as captives of the oppressive Genoshan regime. All right, so let's try and unpack that one real quick. What you got, buddy?
Well, the opening scene of this is phenomenal, I think. I don't think we ever get his name, do we? This guy fleeing from the magistrates.
I don't know that we do. I'm not sure yet. The one who's got a baby or a toddler, yeah, or whatever. He's trying to save his child, yeah.
So he appears to have this kind of childlike simplicity to him. He speaks in these sort of broken phrases, but he's got this very protective approach to this baby who he stows on the airplane. But when he's actually murdered, that's horrific. It's all framed in red, and he's lying there issuing his dying words as he's gloated over by the magistrates. And in his dying words, he's just happy that the baby is safe. And there's a really tragic, poignant feel to that.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, it's a gut-wrenching moment, and it's what Claremont does so well. He makes you care about a throwaway character, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at the same time, he's also, and this goes on throughout all the issues, but he's very quickly establishing that this entire nation, this government, this military, it's this horrible, oppressive system, and it's awful for mutants. I mean, sometimes it's hard to stomach some of the stuff that happens to people, and Claremont, you know, masterfully establishes this real quickly.
Yeah, and this reminds me as well of the, I think it's from issue 210, where the Marauders first appear, but they're all in silhouette, and they kill one of the Morlocks, Tommy, and her boyfriend.
Okay.
It's very similar framing to that, I think. You know, barely seeing what's happening, and someone is brutally murdered, and it's a setup to this much darker story that's coming.
And we should probably say, I mean, essentially what this four-issue storyline is, and it establishes it right here in the first few pages, this is the story of mutant apartheid. I mean, and I don't think Claremont was even trying to hide that.
No, there's nothing subtle about this whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, it's 1988. I mean, it's in the public consciousness at this point, too. So, yeah.
So then we get to the scene with the Press Gang here, and you had an interesting observation about one of these characters.
Well, I really like, I know, you're talking about Punch-Out. So the female strong character is named Punch-Out, and I read this, or reread it, on Marvel Unlimited, so I did panel by panel, and when you read panel by panel, you can tell clearly her name has been changed. I don't know what her character's name was originally, but it was not Punch-Out, because you can see where they've had to white out her name or glue a new name on top of it, and like, oh, I wonder what she used to be. So clearly he probably named her a character and they found out it was a copyrighted name or something. That's probably what happened. But Punch-Out was interesting. For me, though, I loved Pipeline. I thought Pipeline was a fascinating idea. He's just someone who teleports people. But the way he does it, using his power, he digitizes people. But then he has to use a computer to transmit via modem to where he wants them to go. And so he is digitizing people and sending them places. And I thought that's a really cool way to use a mutant who has a power, but also combine it with an outside external force, in this case a computer, to enhance it and make it even better. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, you have to wonder how he figured out he could do that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Is he just digitizing people and then end up floating off into the ether or something?
Well, I was just thinking, like, hey, where's Scruffy the dog, honey? Yeah. I don't know.
He is data now. But
right. Well, and also, it's sort of interesting, this press gang, and I don't know that they ever explore this, but there are certain people that work for the Genosian government that have powers that are not mind-wiped, right? Mm. Like, at this point, we haven't, and I'm leading us ahead, but we're going to see a whole bunch of mind-wipe mutants, or they call mutates, or mutes. These people, they have their memories. They have, they know who they are. They have individualistic identities. So I guess there's different hierarchy of mutants within the Genosian power structure.
Well, we see later that they'd sculpt the mutants' powers to fit whatever purposes they need. So if they're people who are loyal to the regime, then they can use their powers in particular ways and sort of develop these skills, which might explain also why Pipeline has these very specific skills, because they were meant to be that way.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like here as well that it establishes when Madeline and Jenny arrive that Madeline is a fighter right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as she lands and they start to abduct Jenny, she just hurls sand in one of the press gang's eyes and starts to run for it. So, yeah, she's not a passive victim from the start by any means.
And I had forgotten that Madeline was a support character during this era. Until I started rereading these issues, I'm like, what's Madeline doing there? She's not with Scott. And then it had to kind of all come back to me that, oh, yeah, she was there as a support person. She was doing all the computer work. She is stooping havoc, which is kind of crazy. That
it's complicated.
Right. She's sleeping with her brother-in-law, which is like, what? You know?
While her ex-husband has gone off with her doppelganger.
That's true.
Who was dead and left her and her baby behind, and she's now separated from her baby. So it's a whole complicated situation.
Now, I believe she's the only one on the team that knows Jean Grey's alive at this point, I think, if I remember right. Because I don't think anyone else has realized it yet.
I think you might be right. I don't know if she does know, actually.
Well,
this might be a tangent. But
yeah, okay, we'll save all this for later, because we're going to have a bigger talk about Madeline Pryor, because there's a lot to unpack there.
Okay, so then we see X-Men coming to check out the situation. I really love this sequence generally. It's a lot of detective work from Wolverine, and the team working together as detectives, actually, which is really very effective. And frankly, Batman could learn a few things from these people.
From the teamwork side, I like that Psylocke is projecting herself onto Rogue. So they're combining essentially their power set, with Gateway to teleport. So you're right. It is literally teamwork, which you don't see happen with a lot of superhero teams.
Yeah, and I love Psylocke's butterfly motif that's been there since the early days. Yes, that's a really nice, neat trick for showing that telepathy is happening, and it's really stylishly done, yes. Also, Psylocke's costume during this period is her best costume, I would say. The armor.
It looks cool. Now, I'm not the world's biggest Psylocke fan. Like, I came to her, like, for me, I guess she just, like, I felt like she just showed up one day. And I'm like, I feel like she just showed up and she was on the team. And I'm like, I don't even know who this person is, And telepathy is always a power that makes me feel uncomfortable anyway, because you don't want to know what happens in my head. And so, I don't know. I never fell in love with this character. I know a lot of people do. I'm not poo-pooing her. I'm just saying she's not one for me necessarily. And also, like, you mentioned earlier, the British Psylocke is important. So, like, Claremont goes to extreme lengths to write everyone's dialect, right? Sugar and y'all and all that. I never see any British affectation to Psylocke's dialogue.
That's interesting. There's quite a lot of British dialogue when she first appeared, in the Alan Davis issue where she fights Sabretooth.
Okay.
I think it's 213. So yeah, there's a lot of British dialogue in there, to the extent that when that was reprinted in a British annual aimed at younger audiences, they actually changed some of it.
Yeah, oh.
Censored some of her dialogue because it was deemed too fruity.
Oh, talking about shag. All right, love it.
Yeah, yeah. But it is weird with the how Psylocke came into the X-Men. There was always that sort of connection between Captain Britain and that side of things and the X-Men. And when I was reading that as a kid, I felt the same. Like, where does she come from? I must have missed something.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go back and read it, and you're like, no, she just turn up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I just assumed I'd missed an issue or some appearance somewhere else. But I think she's a great addition to the team. And yeah, again, she's, as we'll see in a later issue, she's quite a hardcore character too.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we get a fight between the X-Men and a bunch of magistrates. And yeah, I don't think this action is great, to be honest. I don't think Leonardi does action particularly well. I like his character stuff. The action always kind of feels a little stilted to me.
Okay.
What do you think?
I hadn't thought about specifically the action. I mean, my note on Leonardi. Now, first of all, I gotta warn you, I'm a stand for Leonardi. The Spider-Man 2099 stuff, which is still a few years away from this, so maybe he developed between then and there. I'm a complete sucker for his 2099 stuff. So for me, I feel like, especially when I'm reading this, I feel like his style is sort of frenetic. It's very dynamic. It feels like there's always motion going on. I think P. Craig Russell does a better job inking him in this issue than Terry Austin will later. I think Terry Austin was probably more faithful to the pencils, which maybe Rick Leonardi needs a stronger inker. Someone that takes a little more license and creativity. But like I think pre-Craig Russell probably did here. So I love this. But then again, I'm programmed to love his style. So I don't see the stiltedness. But it's definitely stylized. It's not cartoony, but it's by a cartoonist, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Can you see my distinction?
I see what you mean. I definitely appreciate him now a lot more than I did back then, where I was very averse to Leonardi's appearances on the book, which is why this particular storyline didn't really grab me that much at the time, because every other issue was by an artist I didn't like.
Sure. They had to crank out 2 a month, so yeah.
And I definitely appreciate his craft. He's a fantastic draftsman, but I think it kind of falls down a little on the action. And sometimes, say on page 25, you've got a lot of panels there.
I don't have page numbers on Marvel Unlimited, but is that the one with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 panels?
yeah, the one with hundreds of panels, basically.
Yes.
And it all gets a little bit cramped and a little bit awkward, and yeah. And there's a lot of dialogue going on in those boxes as well, so it does get a little cramped.
Well, I think this page is the only thing Longshot does the entire 4 issues. So, hey, you know, give the man some credit.
pretty much. I always like to see Longshot do stuff and hurl his little knives, bless him.
Yep.
and there's also a fantastic Claremontism on this page as well, which at the top of that page, you've got a scene happening, and there's lots of unattached dialogue balloons from local Australians who are not seen on panel. You just hear their voices.
Yeah, good point.
This happens quite a lot in Claremont comics. I remember there's a particularly good example of this in, I think it's 218, where they fight Juggernaut in Edinburgh. And you just hear lots of very weird English and Scottish dialogue. Well, I think it's supposed to be Scottish, but it's mainly English. in unattached balloons. It's his way of doing a crowd scene without getting an artist to draw loads of people.
That's clever. But one of the things, too, about this is that Claremont, he's trying to create something that never comes to fruition. He's trying to create the X-Men as a local Australian team. Like, they were going to be the superhero team of Australia. Even, like, they develop a symbol. You know, they have a symbol in here, too. And it never really comes together. But I love that he was trying to do that, to make them the local superhero team that everyone would rally behind.
Yeah, that's what the whole last page is about, where you see a bunch of policemen looking at this group of magistrates wrapped up in girders and talking about this mysterious local team. But there's a lot of character stuff given to these two policemen who will never show up again.
right. It's but like, that's Claremont's way.
It is, and it just helps to sort of flesh out the world and make it feel lived in, and the people there. It's not just all about the protagonists, you know.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next issue. Uncanny X-Men 236. Wolverine and Rogue wake up in Genosha naked. In the country of Genosha, it's a tropical paradise with a dark secret here. So mutants on this island are treated as commodities, forced into labor camps, they're mind wiped, and they're stripped of their rights. Now, Wolverine and Rogue battle through the magistrates, again, in their birthday suits, and they locate Madeline and Jenny Ransom, but our heroes are taken down by a Genosian officer named Wipeout, who's a mutant who literally erases their superpowers. Elsewhere, we're introduced to the Gene Engineer, which, by the way, I'm going to have trouble saying this word. I say Gene Engineer, but it's clearly spelled Gene Engineer. So it's a joke on Gene and Engineer. Anyway, this man is responsible for manipulating the powers of the mutant slave population. And we're also introduced to the Gene Engineer's son, Philip. Now, while Philip lives in the lap of luxury, he is completely ignorant as to how the mutant workforce is cultivated. And his eyes are sadly opened when he discovers his fiancée, the aforementioned Jenny Ransom, has been arrested and is being genetically modified to serve the slave workforce. Now, back to our heroes. With no powers, Rogue is manhandled by the magistrates, and is bordering on sexual assault. Having lived her life untouched, she's unaccustomed to this treatment, and she mentally retreats into herself. So then the persona of Carol Danvers comes to the surface and takes control of Rogue's body for the remainder of the storyline. So Carol slash Rogue turns the tables on her captors and frees Wolverine, and Logan is in a very, very bad way without his healing factor. So our heroes are powerless, they're still trapped in Genosha, but they're free and on the run. Meanwhile, the X-Men investigate their teammates' disappearance and determined that they are going to rescue their comrades. All right, so what'd you think of this one, buddy? Now, this is art by Mark Silvestri, right?
Yeah, so I'm on board. I mean, yeah, as I say, I'm art sensitive, so maybe it's just that perspective, but I feel this is a much stronger issue than the first. And this opening sequence where you've got naked Rogue and Wolverine just tearing through a pile of magistrates who've teleported the wrong mutants into Genosha.
Yeah, right.
Is superb. I mean, they're completely overpowered, these poor humans here. And I just absolutely love this. There's even a shot on the second page of a bunch of magistrates in the foreground, and there's just bodies flying past them in the background, which looks like the opening credits to Batman.
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal art right out of the gate. I mean, this tells you why Silvestri is on his way to stardom, right? I mean, this issue, he's just absolutely spectacular. And yeah, I love Wolverine and Rogue in this situation. And I love also the clever artwork, you know, where there's like, you know, debris just clearly covering the naughty bits, you know, like, yeah. All the different parts, just carefully avoiding showing all the good stuff. But yeah, when Wolverine slices through that door, it's like, you know, it's whatever they call it. It's like a foot thick omnium steel. And he just cuts a hole and punches, and Rogue punches through it. Just that for me is like, oh, that's X-Men. Okay, I'm excited now. Bring it, bring it.
But that would make his claws absurdly long. Let's just imagine.
Well, it's all dependent on what they need for the story. And they're made of bone anyway, so.
No, they're not. Absolutely not.
I was baiting you.
There ain't no bone claws, and there never were. But yeah, this whole, and I love the fact we just leap straight into this. There's no, scene of Rogue and Wolverine arriving, going, where the hell are we? It's just straight into, they're absolutely dominating the situation. Yeah, this is phenomenal. But then it doesn't last long. They soon lose their powers.
Yeah, that Wipeout character. Interesting. You know, at first I thought he was like a minister or something, the way he was drawn. But taking away their powers is just so, it's upsetting, right? You know, it's like, and it's going to play a big role in the rest of the story. They're going to be powerless through the rest of the story, Wolverine and Rogue, which makes for an interesting setup.
I just noticed he looks like Wilford Brimley.
He does.
So then we move on to the following page, where we see Philip, the Gingineer's son, waking up in bed. And I think this is a beautiful page as well. No action on here, but it really establishes him as this sort of lazy, kind of privileged teenager. And the art here, Silvestri's layouts and the way he shades and the way everything is penciled makes it look like early Giffen stuff, I think.
I can see that. I totally see that. And you mentioned the luxury that they live in, or however you phrase it. Like, I love this contrast, right? It's showing the Gingineer. He's in the suburbs. They've got this posh life. You know, he's tending his garden. That's, you know, how he's in a position in life where he can, you know, worry about his garden and this posh lifestyle. And then there, you see the slave work for it. Like, the garden gets damaged by a ship, a air car flying away. And it's contrasted with this mutant slave who comes and heals the grass. And he also speaks in this very simplistic way, you know, fix good, boss, fix good is new. They refer to him as boy at one point, which is, I'm sure that was intentional, a reference to racism there. And one thing we didn't even mention about Genosha here is they established very early on that it has this booming industry. You know, it's a high-tech society. They've got flying cars. You know, they advertise, and this is going to come out more, but I'll just share it now. But, like, they advertise no poverty, no hardship. You know, it's this free land where you're judged by your deeds and your character, not the color of your skin. Well, you get judged by your genetic makeup, though. You know, they even go to say it's a nation of 10 million people, and it's almost entirely dependent upon the superpowered mutant slave force that's only a few hundred of them.
Yeah, it's really presented as this amazing utopia, but with a dark underbelly.
Yeah, very much so.
So then we get to a scene where the Gingineer is discussing the situation, and he actually mentions that he wishes the press gang had left the X-Men where they found them. And I was thinking about that, and that would have been the end of it. I'm not sure how they would have ever found Madeline had the press gang not made this mistake and sent Wolverine and Rogue to Genosha.
Yeah, good point. And it is also sort of hard to, like, this is, when I first read the story years ago, this is one of the things I had trouble accepting, was that here's an island nation that no one even realizes that there's, you know, they've got all this slave camps and the way they're treating people and how the society is entirely built on the backs of slave superpowered people. And the mutants, like the X-Men, have never heard of this, you know? So that is a little bit of a hard piece to swallow. And they go to great lengths to talk about how they've kept it a secret and everything. But anyway, that was one piece I had trouble with reading originally.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a no prize in there about how they've escaped the notice of Cerebro over the years.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Good point. Good point.
Although it does make mention of the fact that the magistrates are psi-shielded. So presumably that's applies to the mutates there as well. So
good point. Yeah. Yeah. So the Gingineer, what's his real name?
Is Dr. Moreau. It's a tad on the nose. It's a
just
little
a bit
on the nose.
Because the Gingineer, what his job is to manipulate, you know, the powers of the mutates to be better citizens. Like, say, okay, this guy's got this power. We could use him, you know, in the gardens. Or this person, their powers aren't quite what we want. So I'm going to genetically alter their powers so that they can go work in the mines or whatever. That's his job.
I'm always there for allusions to classic sci-fi, so I'm not averse to it. Of course, then we come back to a scene where back in Australia, the X-Men are interrogating the captured magistrates. And this is where we see Betsy really coming into her own. Betsy being Psylocke.
Right, right.
With just a brutal interrogation sequence where she just, without any hesitation, leaps into the mind of this magistrate and sees the horrors therein and then, yes, wishes to do him extreme harm.
That page by Silvestri is haunting. It's exceptionally well done with the butterfly effect in the middle, so you know all of this is what she's reading in the minds. You see the slaves, they're just their eyes, or you know, they even focus in on the eyes to show the haunted look and the tattooed numbers. You see the way that the people are treating these slaves and beating them.
Skulls and torture, and it's a horrific scene. I mean, this is clearly kind of Holocaust imagery there going on here.
And you can understand, you can relate to her wanting to pretty much, you know, kill these people. She's so furious. Now, I will say, for a telepath, you know, usually telepaths, there's all this like high and mighty, you know, have to respect people's privacy. Nope, not with Psylocke. She has no reservations about reading people's minds against their will. And then even later in the story, she'll go on to control people's actions and just take control of their body. Mm. She's out of F's to give when it comes to telepathy.
I mean, she's always been written as a warrior even before she became a ninja. And I think that's what was more interesting about her back then, like that initial appearance in X-Men where she fights Sabretooth.
Mm-hmm.
He's pretty much immune to her psychic powers. So she kind of has to fight him physically despite being not on his level. And, you know, that really establishes her as a fighter. But yeah, she's always been a hardcore character. And yeah, no more so than here. The terrified look on the face of the guy she's interrogating is quite haunting as well.
Yes. And this is probably, because again, I've never really taken a Psylocke. Like this, though, it makes me more interested in the character, reading this story. Because I'm like, wow, there's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah. I think just eventually she'd be turned into a sexy ninja. And it's like, yes, that's a lot less interesting.
Well, didn't that just happen because Jim Lee wanted to draw somebody Asian? Like, I believe that's what it was, right?
Very possibly, yeah.
Yeah. That's what I always heard, but who knows?
There's all sorts of complications with that we probably shouldn't get into now.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, so let's focus back here. So from there, you get this scene inside Rogue's mindscape, right, where all the people that she has possessed, because remember, she gets not just their power, she gets their memories, and all of them have remained inside her consciousness as echoes, right? And again, she was without her powers, and they even say, like, the soldiers took advantage of her. Now, they make it very clear in the next issue, they didn't rape her, but it was borderline. They were taunting her. They were telling her they were going to do these things to her. And Rogue has spent her whole adult life untouched, right? She can't have romantic interactions with people. So this sort of assault is especially damaging. It would be to anyone, but especially to her, someone who's never been touched. And so she retreats into her mind, and there's Carol Danvers. You know, amongst all these echoes of people she's absorbed, there's Carol Danvers saying, look, kid, you're not ready for this. I am. I'm taking over. And so the Carol Danvers persona takes control of Rogue's body and will stay in control throughout the rest of this issue. And when you think of Carol Danvers, we think of, you know, Captain Marvel, you know, out in space, but we're talking about the Carol Danvers that was a spy, that was an agent that can kick a bunch of ass with martial arts. That's the Carol Danvers that takes over here.
Yeah, I think this is really fascinating. I mean, it's potentially a touchy issue, I think, especially when you consider how, I mean, this is essentially dissociative identity disorder, which is really difficult to say.
It is.
Yeah, but you know, there's certain schools of thought on this, that this is how it actually functions, that it's a coping mechanism to deal with trauma. And we saw that in the Moon Knight TV show too. That's how it was treated there. But yeah, I think it's really fascinating. It sort of turns this drawback of Rogue, that she's permanently absorbed Carol Danvers, and this causes her all sorts of psychological issues, with this constant presence in her head. But in this particular instance, it becomes an asset. You can suddenly become a super spy, essentially.
Right.
So I think there's something quite empowering about that, about turning your condition into your strength.
And from there, I mean, this whole storyline really, it really is a showcase for Wolverine and Carol Danvers. I mean, or Rogue, whatever you want to call it. The all four issues, it's mainly about them. Most of the other X-Men, I mean, Storm gets a little bit to do. Psylocke gets a little, like we said. But like, again, Longshot does nothing. Colossus does nothing. So it's really Wolverine and Carol. And I love they go by nicknames. So like Wolverine's going to call her Ace, which is the nickname. Because Wolverine and Carol Danvers were partners way back in the day, apparently. Mm-hmm. I mean, retroactively. And so he calls her Ace and she calls him Patch. And so I do love that. This is the story of two powerless badass agents, essentially.
And it is retroactive, certainly, their partnership, but it goes back quite a way because it was first mentioned in X-Men 154.
Okay,
which is part of the first Brood saga, where they allude to their history together there. And then they team up again in a similar manner to this, where they're on an undercover spy mission in 158. which also involves running a virus that erases all mention of the X-Men from the government's computers, which we see in this story too.
They don't come out and say it, but I'm assuming the virus that keeps erasing every mention of the X-Men is not actually a virus at this point. I'm assuming that's the mumbo-jumbo that Roma did for them, right? Making them invisible?
I think so, but I do have a vague memory because Madeline became the team's computer expert. I have a vague memory of her perhaps setting that up. I tried to find this and I can't find it. This may be an implanted memory.
All right, fair. Well, so, she was their computer. She was the girl in the chair for a while there.
Yes, and Logan and Carol would team up again in issue 258, where Logan is on the run, but this time he's kind of a figment of his imagination. But we again get the Carol and Ace and Patch team up.
Nice. And Wolverine is pretty much dying here without his healing factor. I mean, he is very, very sick. And I don't know whether it was just they're saying he needs the healing factor to survive, or they're trying to, you know, retroactively in my head, I'm thinking, okay, this guy's 100 years old, or he has to have the healing factor to survive because, whatever things he's got. But I think it's just because he needs it to survive it here.
Well, they mention in the next issue, the Gene Engineer mentions that his hemoglobin count is abnormally low, and that's why he's dying. And given that hemoglobin comes from your bone marrow, it's reasonable to assume that, although they don't explicitly state this, that the adamantium is interfering with his production of hemoglobin, which would normally be compensated for by the healing factor.
Oh, right. That makes sense. Because like the adamantium, it's actually covering the bone claws. So the hemoglobin is probably blocked.
Covering the what?
bone claws.
No.
Did you remember that episode where they came out and it spiraled like fingernails? Remember that?
That definitely never happened. If you imagine this. It's an implanted memory.
Now, all right, spoilers for X-Men 97. We saw in X-Men 97, a Magneto yanks all the adamantium out of Wolverine's body. So I am just waiting for in X-Men 98, or whatever they're going to call season 2, that he's going to have bone claws. You know it's going to happen.
I'm not watching season 2.
Oh my gosh!
Not happening.
Okay, fair enough.
If anyone can make it work, X-Men 97 can. So.
That's probably true. It did always bother me. The claws are supposed to be razor thin. How do you fit a bone in there? Anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. They're also round and knobbly when they come out. They look like a pretzel.
So Philip, unfortunately finds out all this stuff about his fiance, the girl that's been kidnapped, the expatriate girl. And I mean, it's shocking to I lack the words here, folks. I'm trying. Just to see the Gene Engineer, his dad, basically say, no, this is the way it's going to be. Some people are born this way, and it's their job to support our government. They're the reason we're so successful. And, it's just fate. And yes, you loved her, but now she's going to be a slave. And it's so upsetting.
I mean, this is an apartheid allegory, but it's also applies to many different types of societies that people only become interested in greater social problems once they become personal.
Yeah, good point.
You see this a lot that, we'll put up with all sorts of indignities and social injustice, but as soon as it hits your taxes, then it's personal. Then you must do something about it. And yes, the same thing is, this willful ignorance that Philip is displaying here. And, some of it he knows because he sees it around him all the time. He must know that these sort of childlike people fixing the gardens and running the garbage disposal are not equal citizens. But, he chooses not to think about it.
Yeah. Willful ignorance is right. Absolutely right. Yeah.
Just to mention as well, I love that montage scene of the people Rogue absorbed. There's a few geeky little Easter eggs in there because you can see the specific issues they're taken from. So there's lots of X-Men issues, obviously. Also Avengers Annual 10, and not just with Carol, but there's Thor in there and Captain America. And also Fantastic Four versus X-Men, X-Men versus Alpha Flight. So
yeah, I was going to say, I get some Alpha Flight. I was so excited. So, and put a pin in this for later, we do see Madeline being subjected to the process, and on the TV monitor, suddenly a demon shows up, right? So he's been sort of coming along for several issues, sort of hinting that there's some demon that's trying to talk to her, and she's just very quietly, he's like, oh, is this a bad time? And of course, everyone in Genosha is like, why is there a demon on the TV? What the hell's going on? And Madeline doesn't seem bothered by it at all. She's just like, later, call me later. Don't bother me right now. So they're starting to set up something we'll be talking about pretty soon. All right, let's get into Uncanny X-Men 237. This issue, now this is the one I said felt like it was a little bit of padding, but it's not, though, because this issue delves so deeply into the oppressive system of the Genosian government, right? It talks about the police brutality, about the mutant slave force, so while I felt like it was padding, it really does flesh out the Genosian regime. So you really begin, I'm not saying you relate to it, but you understand what's going on more. So, now meanwhile, the X-Men have arrived in Genosha and are seeking their adopted teammates. And back at the Genosian Citadel, Madeline Pryor is submitted for conversion to the mutant slave force. However, the telepathic intrusion, it apparently activates some previously unknown mental powers in her, as she projects a psychic shockwave of unimaginable power, completely slaughtering her captors. And this psychic feedback is so powerful that it even injures Psylocke, who's miles away. Elsewhere, Wolverine, who's getting sicker by the hour here, along with Carol Danvers slash Rogue, they stow away on the Genosian Mutant Train, which is an express train taking the mutant workforce to their slave labor camp. And while they're there, our heroes connect with Philip, the gene engineer's son. They rescue Philip from the magistrates in the labor camp, and they take him on the run with them. So that's 237. Again, padding's not the right word. It's just this issue is to inform you, I feel like, what's going on in Genosha. But then, when I found out all the other things Claremont had written, that's when I started thinking, oh, maybe this issue was like, okay, I got 18 other things I'm writing. I just got to get through this one. I don't know.
Maybe. And he certainly doesn't skimp on the dialogue in here.
Well, it is Claremont.
I think it's less padding, as this is, it's a less fast-paced issue.
Okay.
Less action-heavy. There's a lot more, as you say, about the social context in which all this is happening. So it's really fleshing out the world here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a valuable issue in this story.
Oh, absolutely.
But perhaps not the most exciting of them.
Yeah, and they try to throw some action in the beginning, I think, to give you a little bit of action, mm-hmm. but it's wasted time. They're just trying to investigate a car that's empty, you know, whatever. But but you get the infomercial. That's where you get a lot of this information. And boy, does that infomercial, when the news reader on TV is reading all this stuff about the way Genosha's set up and their industry and telling you the pitch they want the rest of the world to think, that feels extremely Frank Miller to me. Like, this feels very Dark Knight Returns. Like,
yeah, 100%. Layout as well. And, yeah.
Yeah, in layout. And even the lady, like, if you told me that panel was taken from Dark Knight Returns, I'd probably believe you, you know?
God, yeah, you're right.
And this is Rick Leonardi with inks by Austin at this point. So it's a little bit different art style than P. Craig Russell. But yeah, it feels very Dark Knight Returns. And again, it's dark because you're reading it and they're talking about how great our country is. But you know that really behind the scenes, it's all being supported by slaves.
Mm. Yeah, it's grim stuff, but it's standard propaganda behavior, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah, just looking at that picture of Wolverine in the bottom there, that could also be Frank Miller as well. It's the inks that are doing this. Yeah, interesting stuff. But yeah, in that opening sequence as well, which is kind of throwaway. Yeah, as you say, there's four pages here and not a lot of consequence happens, but there's quite a lot of chat. But again, I just appreciate how Claremont throws a lot of character stuff into background people who are of no consequence to the story. Really.
Right.
Just you hear the thoughts of random magistrates as they're investigating this flying car. And yeah, they're all named and you know they all have sort of a personality to them, which is, I don't know, there's just a lot of attention to detail and texture, which I always appreciate from.
It feels like a more lived-in world. And yeah. I think that's, you know, growing up on this, I think I want that from my comics, is I want random bystander number three to be a person. I want him to have thoughts and have feelings and be involved in the story because they're not just supporting characters in the real world. They have their own story.
Exactly. Yeah. So then we get to Rogue and Wolverine exploring the city here. And it's not Rogue, is it? It's Carol.
Yeah, fair.
Where Carol decides to dress up in a glamorous manner to infiltrate a bar and ensure that no one looks at her face.
Rick Leonardi can draw a beautiful woman. Let me tell you. Oof. Got a little warm in here when I was reading this.
I see. She's just a drawing, Shag. She's just a drawing.
We read comics for reasons. Well, you have your reasons. I have mine.
It's not like it's Alan Davis drawing Nightcrawler. Come on. So there's also a moment of just a passing moment of casual cruelty when we see one of the mutants who's responsible for running the garbage truck here. Passing magistrates get splashed as she's cleaning the streets. And so they just sort of crumble up a cigarette and make him pick up every last bit with his stretchy powers. And it's just this sort of, it reinforces this casual nature. It's not just sort of a necessary evil that the society is going through, but they're corrupt to the core. They're corrupted to the soul.
Absolutely. And that's where this issue, I hate to say shines, because that sounds like, you know, it's great. But no, that's where this issue's exploration of these topics is so powerful and hits it home about the treatment of the slaves. Yeah.
they're willing to go along with everything that happens and actively relish in it sometimes too.
Yep. Power corrupts.
Mm-hmm. But then we get more spycraft from Carol and Wolverine in the bar. And I love the scene where they basically kick off a fight.
Yeah!
And then Wolverine picks everybody's pockets to get some ID.
Well, they both do.
They can make it. Yeah.
I love that Carol and Patch both knew to pick everyone's pockets without even communicating it to each other. It's great. And yeah, there's a great panel of him. Wolverine's actually yelling, "Hey, everybody, fight!" He breaks into a bar brawl.
The jagged lines around it as well.
But it's another example of cruelty. The soldiers here are what ends up starting it because they're bullying this guy at the bar, who turns out to be Philip, the gene engineer's son. But they start bullying him, and they treat him horribly because they're power tripping. You know, it's telling a story of essentially police brutality is what they're trying to tell.
Yeah, power corrupts. And they ruled it, and they cart him off to the camps.
And that's where we get the mutant train. Which, it's strange to think, you know, Wolverine and Rogue trying to ride the top of a train would be difficult. But again, they're completely powerless. And it's Carol and Patch, you know, essentially trying to do this. So them trying to hold on for dear life on top of a train is interesting.
Yeah, now this has echoes of the Wolverine film with the bullet train fight.
Didn't even think about that. Okay.
But obviously when they put the mutants on the train, send them off the camps, this is obviously another Holocaust reference. So we're bringing both apartheid and the Holocaust, sort of picking and choosing from various oppressive societies and systems all over the place to make not very subtle points here. But doing so really poetically, I think.
Well, and I think it's important too, because keep in mind, this is 1988. So I'm a 16-year-old kid, and I'm reading this. And I learned a little bit in school, and you know, sure, about the Holocaust, everything. But here, they're putting it in entertainment. You know, that's one of the beauties of science fiction is you can tell a story that echoes about what happened in the real world. And so it puts in a context that a kid can understand and feel more too. It's like, oh, these are my characters. I love these characters. Oh, this horrible thing's happening. Oh, I get it. Yeah, it's not subtle. I knew what it was, but it's like, oh, you know, it helps reinforce how horrible it was. It's sort of like V, you know, when Kenneth Johnson wrote V, it was to reinforce for a younger generation what the Holocaust meant. And occupation. And so using science fiction, in this case, it's comic books, to tell a previous story to make kids care is important, I think.
And on the next page, we get this same sentiment echoed by Jenny, who's actually being sent off to the camps and is about to have her mind wiped and turned into a tool of the state. And she too has this idea of it's not fair because it's happening to her, despite the fact she knew how the system worked, more or less. But again, it's only when it becomes personal that it becomes a problem.
So there's that side of it. And then the other side is how horrifying it is to read this guy who's essentially, it was going to be her father-in-law, just basically very calmly telling her, says, no, you're going to get your mind erased, but this is a good thing. You know, you're going to help our society. It isn't fair, but yeah, our society you're going to be the backbone of what helps our society thrive. So yeah, it's okay. Don't worry. And like,
heartbreaking line where she asks, will I at least still be a nurse? He says, your progeny will be exceptional healers, but your talents must be oriented in other directions. So she's going to have powers that will help her shape metal and stone. She's going to be a miner, essentially, rather than a healer. So her personal skills and ambitions count for nothing in this society.
Well, and leading up to that, he says, you know, believe me, this is as hard for me as it is for you. Yeah, okay. As you go back to your cushy mansion, pal, and she's going to not even remember who she is tomorrow. Ugh.
The banality of bureaucratic evil. That's it.
Ugh. And then he starts referring to her as, you know, Mutant 9817. He doesn't even call her Jenny, you know, and ugh.
And then this gets worse on the next page. We see Madeline being put into her mutant suit. And this is horrific, right?
the way they've got her strapped to the chair and everything?
Yeah, the way they explain how the mutant suits work. So they all wear these skin suits. And these are hermetically sealed from head to toe. So nothing gets in, nothing gets out. It deals with waste. It recycles all bodily fluids. And obviously this has consequences for birth, for childbirth.
Yeah.
So she asked, what about children? And it's revealed they basically extract your genetic material and make a child in a lab. And the particularly chilling phrase they use here, the gene engineer says, babies are decanted right down the hall.
Yeah. Ugh. Now, there's a real irony that Madeline Pryor is being talked about being cloned and all these things, because we'll find out very soon she is a clone and she was decanted and all of this stuff, and specifically so she could have a baby. So anyway.
But this is where Maddie starts to turn the tables a little somehow.
This is absolutely, I mean, right here is the beginning of the Goblin Queen. We don't see it yet. That won't be till next issue. But the very fact that as a reader, I'm sure we were, you know, we were reading this going, wait a minute, what happened? How did all these people die? How did this mental backlash come out of Madeline? Madeline doesn't have priors. It was Jean that had powers. What's going on? And this is the beginning of all of that.
Yeah, and the scene after the aftermath of her killing all the lab assistants and trashing the lab. Again, another horror panel. This is straight out of a horror comic.
Yes.
It's all in red. She's surrounded by bodies and mayhem and trashed equipment. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Akira, this.
I can see that. Yeah, there's blood splatters on the wall and the redness. Yeah. Now, bear in mind, when she slaughtered these people, she's still strapped to a chair. Her legs are tied down almost like like a gynecologist. It's awful the way her legs are kind of spread apart. Her arms are held down. She can't move. She did all of this with her mind.
Horrific, but you can't blame her.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And then we come to the end here where Carol, I keep misnaming her, are on the train and they manage to retrieve Philip and swear to burn the country to the ground.
Yeah. Now, again, going back to, I'm not saying it's padding, but there is a lot of almost Doctor Who level of Carol and Logan are captured, not captured, on the run, captured, not captured. So there's a lot of rinse and repeat, but that's okay because we're getting through a story. And also, you didn't have to wait 4 months to read this. You read all of this in 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose it's quite pacey, really, but it's, compared to the other issues, it's a little bit of a slowdown, a little bit more reflective, I think.
But it's necessary to help us understand what happens in Genosha. So again, I'm not calling it padding as a dig. It's just, it's a different pace, and certainly less of a pace than the next issue.
Let's get to it.
So Uncanny X-Men 238 is the finale of the story, and here, in the beginning, we dip into the psyche of Madeline Pryor and discover it is a dark, dark, dark place, now with 100% more underboob. So, yes, folks, the Goblin Queen is very nearly here. Meanwhile, Logan and Carol, or Rogue, whichever, you know, their luck has run out, and they're taken prisoner again. The climactic showdown unfolds as the X-Men are reunited with Logan and Carol, and the magistrates get cornered in this situation because the X-Men have a bunch of hostages, so the magistrates stand down. And Psylocke possesses the mutant Wipeout and uses his abilities to restore Wolverine and Rogue's powers. With Rogue's healing factor restored, he is on the mend. And Rogue is, unfortunately, once again burdened with her absorption powers. Now, Philip, the gene engineer's son, he vows to expose the Genosian Islands' atrocities to the world. And the X-Men threaten the people of Genosha. They say, you better reform your ways and follow Philip's example of mutant equality, or the X-Men will return one day and there will be blood. So that's a big picture of what happens. A lot happens in this issue. So what'd you think of this one? And we're back to Silvestri's art, by the way.
This is phenomenal, especially every single thing that happens with Madeline Pryor in this issue.
Yeah. Let's save that. Because we're going to have that in just a second. But let's save the Madeline discussion.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it brings a story to a nice, if slightly unexpected, conclusion. So yeah, I think there's a sort of an intimation that Wolverine's going to come back and tear this country to the ground. That doesn't actually happen. And it's a much more subtle ending, considering the scale of what had gone before. And perhaps a naively optimistic ending. We could argue.
Yeah, so Philip is the son of the gene engineer. He's going to go to the mainland, and I don't know whether they mean Africa or Australia or the United States or whatever, and he's going to plead the case of saying, look, this is what's happening in Genosha, and the world needs to get involved. And, you know, Genosha should not treat mutants this way anymore. And yeah, the hope, and the X-Men are basically saying, all right, maybe it's the influence of Professor X's dream. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But they do say, all right, we're going to give Philip a chance. As he's standing there with his fiance, who, by the way, has been transformed into a mutate. I'm assuming she's been mind wiped as well. I don't know that for sure. But so he's planning to try the political outrage, you know, to try and shake the trees of politics to make this happen. And, you know, will that work? Spoiler, it doesn't.
No. And just to emphasize the point that the stakes are high, Havoc blows up a skyscraper. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Which, by the way, is since I'm reading Extinction Agenda now, thank you, Matt, for pulling me down this rabbit hole. They rebuild that skyscraper exactly the same, by the way.
Oh, really?
Well, or the art team didn't pay attention and they got blown up. I don't know.
They can rebuild. It's fine. Okay, so we'll come back to Maddie Pryor. There's a lot going on there.
Oh, yeah.
But disregarding that for the moment, I think there's a really nice couple of sequences here where we get two three-way conversations mirroring each other about the state of Genosha. So one is between the Gingineer, Madeline Pryor, and a random magistrate. And then there's another one between Philip, Wolverine, and Carol. So they both have the same subject in mind. They're talking about the ethics of Genosha and how it works, but from different perspectives. So the magistrate and the Gingineer are very complacent about how these things work and very defensive of their system that is established and must not be deviated from, while Madeline's challenging them.
I want to read that dialogue real quick. There's a line, because the Gene Engineer is talking with Madeline about the ethics of all this. And the magistrate says, you're a fool, Gene Engineer, to debate this with her. It gives her views a validity that they do not merit. Either we are right in what we do, in which case the argument's pointless, or we're wrong, in which case the argument is equally pointless. We don't question the course of our lives. We remain true to it. Wow. So yeah. She's saying what we're doing might be wrong, but who cares? Because it's our way of life. And like, damn, she openly acknowledges that what they're doing may be absolutely unethical.
And as Madeline says to her, Sieg Heil to you too, sweetie. Not subtle.
Right. But wow. Just because this is how tyranny happens, though, when people say we're doing it because we have to.
Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that zealotry is Philip, who in his discussion is quite sort of blithely ignorant. Like I say, he was willfully ignorant about what was happening in his country.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because he sort of chose to look the other way because these things weren't of concern to him. In order for the zealotry to take hold, you have to have a passive population who don't really want to know anymore.
Yep. But yeah, those scenes really do parallel each other. Absolutely. You're right. Good observation. I didn't pick up on that.
Yes. So the magistrate says to him, if you were ignorant, young man, it's because you wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yes, sums it up, really. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of dialogue and ethical debate in this one that is really sort of well-considered and elevates this to beyond just another punch-em-up.
I was just thinking that, like, this is a superhero comic? Really?
Yeah.
No, this is deep, thought-provoking stuff about social commentary. And I think, you know, again, reading this at 16, this sort of, you know, maybe helped formulate my worldview in some regards. You know, I'm not saying this particular story, but growing up with the kind of literature where people were willing to say, there are things that are wrong in the world and people should stand up to it, you know, kind of helped form who I was.
Yeah, and I was a little younger, but I can see how it may have had an influence on me too.
Yeah. And again, I'm not saying this specific story, but just all the stuff through the X-Men where they always stood up. They never gave up. They always stood up.
Yeah, this has all been in the DNA of the X-Men forever. So, you know, it's strange when people complain about the X-Men doing progressive social justice issues these days. Like, ever read a comic? I don't know.
Right, yeah. It just goes back to 1962 or so, right? Yeah, 63, yeah. Whatever, whenever X-Men started.
Yeah, so there's also a very nice bit, just a little touch where Wolverine and Carol are captured precisely because they are invisible to machines. So they see Philip walking along, talking to nobody. And suddenly they're surrounded by magistrates.
Right.
So I like the fact that one of their strengths becomes their weakness.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There. Yep. The flip side of that.
The flip side of what happened to Rogue. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Now, I did feel like, and maybe I'm jumping too far ahead here, but I did feel like the magistrates sort of gave up in between pages. Like, you know, they're fighting the magistrates, and then they capture the Gene Engineer, and you go to the next page, and the magistrates have already surrendered. It, like, happened in between pages.
When the X-Men show up, you mean?
Yeah, so I'm much further in the issue now, because I'm skipping all the Madeline stuff. So, yeah, so the X-Men have shown up, they're battling the magistrates, and then suddenly everyone's surrendered.
Well, you probably would.
I would.
Definitely outgunned there. But there is a nice moment where Wolverine, without his healing factor, leaps into action and, you know, pretty sure he might not survive this one, which is just a nice touch.
Yes. And Rogue's pissed at him for it. Or, I'm sorry, Carol is pissed at him for it. Yep.
Although, should he be able to extend his claws is the question.
Well, he does extend. Well, okay. So it's not a power in theory. Oh, I see what you're saying. So if it is a power, well, at that point, I had always thought the claws were some sort of mechanical trigger that extended them. So if you follow that philosophy, then there's no problem extending the claws here.
Absolutely. At this time, he was known to be basically a cyborg.
Mm-hmm.
It's only later with the retcon, the bone claws, this becomes, well, should he be able to extend his claws if they're part of his power set? Yeah. Let's not get into that because the bone claws never happened. So.
Bone claws.
No. You monster. Yeah, there is some nice, it's not very long, but there's some nice action when the X-Men arrive. It's not a big action scene, but Sylvester just makes it sing.
Yeah, and they gave Dazzler something to do.
Yeah.
It's about, she doesn't do much, but she did this.
Didn't give Longshot anything to do. He looks concerned briefly, but...
Yes. I do like how the X-Men sneak in. So they disguise themselves as magistrates. They sneak in. Because of the rain, they're able to get through the security. They're like, hey, can we go check in inside, please, so we're not standing in the rain? And that allows them to get in, which is kind of a cool moment.
And what I really like about that is they're wearing the magistrates' uniforms. So they're wearing the caps and the jackets. And so you've got Havoc with a mask and a hat over the mask, which is giving Batman vibes to me.
Totally is.
Where is Havoc's headdress under that hat?
Right, yeah. Exactly. It's just like Batman's ears. They're collapsible.
Exactly. So yeah, that's a nice little touch. But I think we should talk about Madeline.
Okay. Oof. All right, I'm going to start us off just to give y'all some history here. So I did a little research on Madeline and things like that. And Claremont, in some interviews, basically said the original plan for Madeline was she didn't have powers. She was just a one in a million chance, looks like Jean Grey. That was going to be it. The whole idea was Scott was going to marry her. They go off to Alaska. And he was going to retire, period. He'd come back for special episodes or whatever. But that's it. It was supposed to be a metaphor for all of us that we grow up and we move on. And Scott grew up and moved on. And Madeline was just his happy ending. That's what it was supposed to be. But once they resurrect Jean in X-Factor number one, and Scott just splits, he leaves Madeline and his child and goes back to Jean, it leaves them with a problem where Scott's, you know, he's supposed to be a hero and a decent human being, but it creates this untenable structure with back with Madeline and his son. What do you do about that? So Claremont at that point felt like the only resolution he had was to turn Madeline into a villain and kill her off. So that's why you get the Goblin Queen story. And that's why there's really not many hints of it until we get to the Australian stuff. There's always going to be a moment where, like, they zoom in on Madeline's eye and you see a flaming bird in her eye or something like that. That was always, you know, like, what? Phoenix, what? But they never paid off till now.
So what you're saying is it's all Kurt Busiek's fault.
Did he, was it his idea for X Factor number one?
He had the idea of how to bring back Jean Grey, which she actually came back in Avengers rather than X Factor. She came back in, I can't remember what issue it was.
Well, it was like Avengers and Fantastic Four, wasn't it? Wasn't it both of them?
I think Fantastic Four guested in that issue.
Okay. All right.
I may be misremembering this, but I'm pretty sure it was Kurt Busiek's idea for how they could bring her back. So yeah, all of this we can attribute to him.
That's fair. I also want to mention, too, and this is something I just found fascinating. In the third issue, when they're inside, or maybe the fourth issue, whenever they're in Madeline's brain, and they see her as a little girl, they see her as a little girl picking flowers and stuff like that, that is a total intentional callback. So if you've ever read Avengers Annual number 10, which is Rogue's first appearance, which I did recently, there's a little girl in there named Maddie Pryor. And as an X-Men fan, when you read that retroactively, your mind explodes. You're like, what? Well, it turns out, just Claremont liked the name. It was just total. He just used it again and didn't care. But here he decided to indulge on this in-joke. So that little girl in issue 238 in the Mindscape is drawn the same way and in the same clothes as the little girl from Avengers Annual number 10. She's even repeating some of the same lines of dialogue. So that's a little in-joke tying that girl from Avengers Annual number 10 to this one, to this Madeline Pryor. Don't look for anything deeper than that. It's just Claremont having some fun.
But there's also a clue here about where he got the name from.
So you have to explain this to me. I didn't know any of this.
Okay. So it mentions that the girl is singing a song, which is Gone to America by a group called Steel Eye Spam, which it actually states in the dialogue there. And whoever's monitoring her says, is that significant? Unknown. Steel Eye Spam is a British folk band from the 1970s, and I guess their lead singer's name, Madeline Pryor.
No way.
Known as Maddie Pryor, yes. Slightly spelled differently, but yeah, he's Maddie Pryor. So obviously Claremont was a fan and just used the name because of he was a fan of her music.
Interesting. But wow.
This obviously raises a question, given that Madeline is a clone and presumably named by Mr. Sinister. Does that mean Mr. Sinister is a fan of British folk music?
Could be. Now, Claremont claims he picked the last name Pryor because it's implying she's a clone, that there was a prior existence for Jean Grey. But I think yours might be more right, especially since he calls her Maddie Pryor in the Avengers Annual. I bet he knew the music. You're right.
Yeah, that can't be a coincidence unless he just decided to retroactively make it a coincidence. or retroactively attribute it to Steel Eye Span, I don't know. So.
Maybe so.
I feel I have to mention, just because I have to shoehorn musical references into everything, that Maddie Pryor is actually the mother of one of my favourite musical artists called Rose Kemp, and I suggest you check out her album, The Golden Shroud, which is very good.
Okay. So, folks, if you don't know anything about Matt, you should know that he is full of insanely obscure musical references that no one on Earth has ever heard of except for him, and many of them pay off. So there we go. All right, so we got to talk about Madeline here. So Madeline is freaking scary in this storyline. Like, she is super below the surface nuts. Like, there's all kinds of stuff where she's just out here and you're following her and she's a bit of a protagonist and you feel bad for what's happening to her. And then she's just talking to a demon. And she's like, yeah, go away. I'll talk to you later. Like, what? What the hell's going on? I mean, the Goblin Queen thing, that she does appear, and I think this may be the first time we see her in this particular outfit. I can't promise that.
Yeah, okay. Definitely is.
Yeah, so she is in the Mindscape as the Goblin Queen. So it's very disturbing and upsetting. But, you know, Shag has to say, smoking hot redhead, plus a whole lot of underboob, is what we might call formative in my youth. So I already, already was in love with Jean Grey. Now I'm in love with Madeline Pryor. So yeah, okay.
She has impact in this issue, let's say.
And then, yeah, later on she's naked, but I think the Goblin Queen outfit's hotter. But anyway.
And it's interesting, we've got the Jean Engineer here in her Mindscape. He is Mr. Sinister.
Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing is, it's not even the gene. So it gets complicated. It's not even the gene engineer. It's actually the telepath that was murdered, that was investigating her mind. But apparently Madeline could tell the telepath was working under orders from the gene engineer. So he appears as a gene engineer. I mean, it's layer upon layer of stuff.
Oh, my God. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. I mean, it's deep.
And she nukes Genosha in her Mindscape as well.
Yeah. And you see the Phoenix Force. You see it as a flaming bird. So, yeah, as a reader, you know, you're like, you've been waiting for this Madeline story to pay off for, what, 30, 40 issues? More than that, probably now. And it's like, oh, my gosh, it's happening. It's finally happening. But it's going to happen in a way you did not expect.
Yeah. And then when we return to the real world and see Madeline in her cell, that panel, the way Sylvester draws her there, is like, she is now in control.
Yes.
Just
yes.
The assertiveness, the confidence, like, she's no longer the victim in the situation. She's just absolutely fierce and knows she's got the upper hand.
And she's saying, I didn't butcher those people. It was self-defense, you know? She now knows. I suspect what's happened here is it's unlocked the Jean Grey psychic powers, and she probably knows she has them at this point. Because later on, they don't show it, but you can infer that she telekinetically smashes her way out of the cell later.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a great panel. I don't know page numbers again, because I'm looking at Marvel Limited, where it's, you know, it's that effect of, it's a close-up on her face, and everything's in shadows except this, you know, vertical or horizontal stripe of light across her eyes, and she's not even saying anything, but it's just that you're looking at it and you're like, oof, yeah, that's it's scary stuff.
They use so much shadow on her in this issue, just really starting to sort of show her being drawn into the darkness in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she's very definitely the hero of this story. But there's a sinister undercurrent to it, and it's really conveyed through the art. It's beautifully done.
Yeah, because I mean, she spends a lot of time away from the X-Men. You know, she's trying to inspire Jenny to try and help her get through this, because she knows what's coming. They even make a reference to the X-Men Alpha, my beloved X-Men Alpha Flight crossover, which I love so freaking much. Awesome. They make a reference to that. But then, you know, she is on her own in the nursery where they decant babies. She's completely naked because she's shed the skin suit. She's naked holding a baby, and she's just dead-eyed face the whole time. And she's manipulated the gene engineer to bring it. She's in control. Again, she has manipulated the gene engineer to come there, and she's basically daring him to shoot her. She's like, yeah, you remember what happened when I got hurt and I murdered all those people in those rooms? Imagine what'll happen if you kill me. And and here she also admits she has an affinity for cloning labs. So then as a reader, you're like, okay, wait a minute, clones, what's going on?
Yeah, there's a lot of track being laid here that's going to pay off. Yeah.
Starting next issue. I mean, the next issue, it begins Inferno.
Yeah. Which is, frankly, a confusing storyline for me, because I don't remember that well. But...
Right. It's a mess. Yeah. It's a complete mess. Absolutely is.
But yeah, I love the lines here as well. Again, she's all in shadow here. She's just looking really... It's not even sinister. It's more so just imposing.
It's absolutely sinister. Yeah. It's absolutely sinister. Well, and terrifying.
Yeah. I sometimes find the line between sinister and sexy quite confusing. So
it's that too. She's naked. So yeah, absolutely.
But she says, the Jean Engineer, she says to him, perhaps I summoned you. He says, then you do have powers. And she says, or the wit to run a bluff and the skill to make it convincing. And for some reason, those lines just stuck with me for years. That's just like... yes, just using her wits to win this fight. She didn't even have to use any powers to defeat him here. And he looks absolutely terrified in the following panel as well. He might. It's just a great sequence. She's such a sinister creation. Yes.
And none of the X-Men are in the room. So none of them even know she has this. I mean, Havoc shows up and she calls him lover because she likes that summer's heat, I guess. But that was a joke. thank you. You may laugh now. But
I only just got that. I'm slow sometimes.
Well, I've been waiting like for 2 hours to use that joke. So anyway, but other than that, none of the X-Men are there. And so they don't see how freaking creepy their girl in the chair has become.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about this. And this is jumping ahead in the X-Men story of what's revealed. You know, that they reveal Madeline is, in fact, a clone of Jean Grey, created by Mr. Sinister, right? I mean, this issue, mm-hmm. these issues, though, have already started showing us, okay, cloning's a thing. There's a lot of references to Mr. Sinister. So they're already laying it all out there, right? But so Madeline becomes the Goblin Queen due to the overwhelming loss of her son and the romantic betrayal by her husband. So I read about it. So she does know Jean Grey's alive. She saw footage of Scott and Jean Grey together with X-Factor, and she's like, WTF. And then she programmed all the computers to not show the X-Men, the scenes of the X-Factor group. So the rest of the team does not know Jean's alive. She's the only one that knows. And so this has been brewing in the back of her head. She hasn't told anybody that Jean's alive. She hasn't told anybody that her husband left her for another woman. So the loss of her son, the betrayal of her husband, that combined with the psychic torture of the Genosians, and then throw in a little bit of literal magic from the devil, from magic's limbo dimension, is what creates the Goblin Queen. It even gets out of control. This is not what Sinister implied, you know, planned. It gets out of his control, too, as she becomes the Goblin Queen. He had planned for her to use her powers and everything, but not go that far. Whereas, if you contrast that with X-Men 97, in there, she is specifically programmed to become the Goblin Queen by Mr. Sinister. So, there's still, she's still cloned. She's still a clone of Jean Grey. In both cases, he wants Jean, this clone and Scott to have a baby, because he wants the baby. But there, he specifically planned for her to become the Goblin Queen. There was no Genosha torture. There was no demons making deals with her. So, it's a little bit different there. It sort of boiled down some of the best points of what made Madeline crazy, or evil, I should say, and put that into X-Men 97. I think it works. I think as a boiled down version of her story, I think it works.
Yeah, the X-Men 97 version, I was a bit disappointed at the time when I first watched it, just because Inferno is such a massive storyline that felt very, very quick and rushed to do it in one single episode. However, as we mentioned, Inferno is kind of a mess. So condensing that down, streamlining it doesn't hurt. And the animation in that episode was phenomenal. It was very much sort of reminded me a lot of sort of the weird end of Studio Ghibli, like things from Pompoko or even not a Ghibli film, but Paprika. I don't know if you've seen that, but this sort of weird demonic dreamscape stuff happening that really sold the entire story. So
it was. I rewatched it last night. It was an exceptional episode. It's good.
It's superb.
Yeah.
There's a slightly awkward note at the end where she just picks the name Maddie Pryor out of the air at random.
Yeah. You know, she could have just said, call me Madeline, you know, like, or that's a name I like. But yeah, call me Madeline Pryor. It's like, okay, that's for the fans. Get it.
Maybe she's a fan of 70s British folk music, too. So.
There you go. She could have been like my favorite band. Yeah, they could have thrown that in there. So I got a what if scenario for you. Mm-hmm. So what if, because I like the what if stories, what if Madeline had not been subjected to Genosha torture or conversion? Would the Goblin Queen have still come? Would have Inferno happened? Or just would have happened differently?
I think it would have happened on a longer time scale. She was already having contact from Nastia. So demonic things were already happening around it. But I think the Genosha incident was a catalyst, a major catalyst. But
that's
given fair. Given that she's hanging around with the X-Men, sooner or later that's going to happen.
Claremont does love to make his female characters turn evil, doesn't he?
Yes, he may do a bit, yeah.
And I don't know whether it's a weird, not sexism, but like, you know, a female gender issue, or whether he just wants to make the female characters powerful and in control. Because he does elevate almost all of his female characters to, you know, really interesting, powerful characters. But he also tends to make them evil. So I don't know, you know, if that's just his trick, the go-to thing, or whether, you know, now you got a problem there, buddy. I don't know. I'm not smart enough to figure that out.
Who's he done that with apart from Jean and Madeline, though?
And Storm and Polaris. All of them at some point. Like Polaris was possessed by Malice for a long time.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Storm. I thought there was a story where she went evil. Maybe I'm imagining that one. But there's a lot of times where the female character, I mean, Rogue essentially was possessed from time to time as well. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was maybe just for a story, an issue or something. But there was a lot of it.
Yeah, fair enough. He's got a thing. He's got
there's a lot to unpack. Now, there's a lot to unpack about Claremont. There's some fantastic podcasts out there that talk about those things. So you should definitely check those out. The names escape me right now. But
the recurring fetish gear is also a trope with him, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So from this point, I already mentioned, you know, the Madeline issue or episode of X-Men 97. So why don't we transition here, and then we'll kind of wrap the whole thing up. So X-Men 97, I think given that we're at the 8-hour mark in this podcast, which is probably going to go a little bit shorter than I originally anticipated. So folks, you've been waiting this long for X-Men 97 discussion. I apologize. But in general, I'll start. I freaking loved X-Men 97. I thought it was phenomenal. I rarely will watch an animated series more than once. Last night, I watched 5 episodes of X-Men 97 again. I planned to watch one, and I watched 5 episodes. I was so into it. The original X-Men cartoon in the 90s, I loved the concepts, and I loved seeing the characters, and I loved that they were touching on stories that I enjoyed as comics, but I couldn't stomach that cartoon series. Like, I tried when it originally went out, but the animation was freaking awful. I mean, it was absolutely horrible in my opinion. Also, I felt like the writing left a lot to be desired. I felt like the voice actors were just belting out their lines with, you know, everyone's yelling, everyone's extreme. And I felt it was very, very plot-driven rather than character-driven. So while I have an affinity for the old cartoon, I don't watch it. I didn't finish watching it, and I don't like it. I don't go back to it. But damn, X-Men 97, like, it took all the best parts of that series and just threw in everything else. And I feel like I'm watching a Chris Claremont comic book come to life. I don't know. How did you feel about that series?
Well, I have very similar thoughts about the original X-Men series.
Okay.
Yeah, I was kind of maybe slightly too old for it at the time, I suppose. But
yeah,
I never got into it. Despite being all about X-Men all the time, it was just not my thing. I agree the animation was horrific. As I've mentioned, I'm very art-focused. Mm-hmm. So I just couldn't watch it. I've seen a handful of episodes, maybe 4 or 5 in total. So when it came around to doing this X-Men 97 series, I had basically no interest in it. This is revisiting a property I didn't like in the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Then some irredeemable podcaster whose name I can't remember basically messaged me and insisted I should watch it. And God damn it, he was right.
I usually am.
Yeah. I didn't say it was you.
Oh, right. Fair. That's fair. Irredeemable Frank. All right. I know.
Yeah. Lots of irredeemable podcasts out there. But yeah, that is, I think it's kind of top tier MCU content. And it's just beautiful on every level. The first episode is good, kind of sets the tone, but just ramps up from there. And episode 5 was one of the most devastating things I've ever seen. Genuinely just crushed after that. It was hard to watch. And yeah, especially considering kind of real world events, I don't really want to get into, but it's very of the moment. It's very present. And yeah, that was a tough watch and a lot happened and I had to sort of leave the room afterwards.
Right.
My daughter was in the room watching. She wasn't really into it, but I just couldn't speak. I had to just leave.
Well, real world events. I mean, so you're right. The first episode is kind of fine. It's like setting the stage. And if you watch it, it's like, okay, that's okay. But episode 2, again, not getting into it, but real world events right there in episode 2. And for me watching it, I was like, holy crap. They did not just address that real world thing. Mm-hmm. Wow. And it was powerful. And like the animation is freaking glorious.
Oh my God. Yes.
It's beautiful. And you mentioned the fifth episode. Like you mentioned Akira earlier. Like for me, that felt a little, because the battle part of it, the explosions and all that, the screaming, the power blasts, like that felt a little Akira to me. Motorcycle slides, you know.
Yeah, there's been an anime thread throughout this, especially as I mentioned. Yeah, the Goblin Queen episode,
mm-hmm.
and strong anime content. Also the life death stuff with Storm and Forge.
Yeah,
the adversary, that was straight out of Ghibli as well, you know. So yeah, it's just phenomenal. One of the best things I've seen. It really makes me concerned for how the MCU is going to handle X-Men in live action, because that's a lot to live up to.
Right. I mean, this is the X-Men that we've always deserved, right? In animation or live action or something. This is what we have always deserved as X-Men fans. And it just paid off. Folks, if you haven't watched it, oh my God. Yeah. Sorry, we are spoiling some things to you. But like, you know, and it's not just the animation, it's the directing. You know, like the director clearly knew how to, I don't know what you call it, animation. I don't have the artistic intelligence to say this, but like he knew the way to move the camera on the animation cells, how to move the characters. You know, the voice acting, holy crap. The voice acting's fun. Like I mentioned, in X-Men, the original series, they're just belting out their lines, yelling them most of the time. Here, the voice acting was really, really well done. And then there's one particular actor, the bad guy, Bastion. That voice actor, and maybe I'm too tuned into audio because I listen to a lot of audio drama. That was one of the best voice actor things I've ever heard. I mean, even though everyone else was good, he stood out. A guy's named Theo James. I don't even know who the guy is, but holy crap, he stood out in his voice. Like, I believed every word he said, regardless of whether I like the character or not, because that's a debatable different thing. The voice acting was just wow. I believed it. That guy was really saying these things.
Oh, I was sold on all of that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Bastion's one of those characters that I didn't even know who that was. That's from my dark period of X-Men where I wasn't reading, so I've never read a single comic he's in. So for him to be the surprise villain of the piece didn't thrill me, I suppose, but it all worked and I was totally into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we should mention the music. So like the incidental music was really, really well done. I love the use of things like one-eyed purple people eater. I mean, that was kind of weird and quirky and fun. But then like one of the things I noticed in my rewatch last night, I didn't notice the first time around, is during big action moments, and there's a lot of them, they will actually use the show's theme song, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. They'll use that as incidental music to emphasize key moments. And damn, I couldn't help it. Like, I could feel myself getting excited when the X-Men theme song would play. I'm like, oh yeah, here we go. Kick some ass, you know? And it drove it. The music drove a lot of the story. And there were moments where, like episode 5, when I guess we won't say what happens, but somebody dies. And the music drives a lot of the sadness of that. And the ending, I mean, I was bawling my eyes out and when I watched it again last night. And that's the second time I've watched that episode. So, all right.
So powerful, man. So it's shockingly powerful for a cartoon, you know.
It really is, right? So, all right. Best episodes. Okay. Number 5, obviously, on the table. It's a Genosha episode, too, by the way, guys. So it's not telling the same story we covered today, but that is what led us to read those comics, is that Genosha is an integral part of the X-Men 97 storyline. So Genosha episode there, probably the best episode. Beyond that, what other episodes are really stand out?
Yeah, the Inferno one, as I say, was really great.
Yep, the third episode. Yep, I agree. That's my second best as well.
I just kind of love the wild animation in that. When you get into sort of demons and dreamscapes and psychedelic visions, they just let the animators rip on that. It was fantastic. But yeah, I kind of, there was one I wasn't particularly keen on, but all of the rest were really strong.
Which one weren't you keen on? I'm just curious.
It's not even a full episode. It's the Motendo.
Oh, okay. We're Jubilees in sort of the video game Mojoverse.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that is the one that perhaps of all the episodes relies the most on nostalgia for being your hook into it.
Huh. Okay.
I'm led to believe that they basically work their way through the entire X-Men arcade game, which I've never actually played. So,
so
it kind of means nothing to me. But.
Well, I didn't even pick up on that. Yeah. And I played the game, but that would make sense. A side scroller. Oh, okay. Well, see, it worked on me without even knowing. Okay.
Revelations in real time. Yeah,
yep. I do want to mention one more episode because you're just taking too much time. is Life Death Part 2. That's the one. If I remember right, it's split into two storylines. It's Storm dealing with getting her powers back and that whole psychological thing, battling the adversary, which, by the way, led me to believe we were going towards Fall of the Mutants. I thought that's where we were heading, was Fall of the Mutants, because they're battling the adversary. But her and Forge out in the middle of nowhere battling the adversary, which was this giant bird creature, which was animated so unbelievably. You talk about a lot of anime in there, too. But, you know, if you think about the original source materials, Barry Windsor Smith. So already it was a different style of art. It wasn't anime, but Barry Windsor Smith was a very different style of art to John Romita Jr. And so here they give you a different style of animation as well. But so you get that. If I remember right, that episode is split, right? Between her story and Professor X's story out in the Shi'ar Empire.
So the first half of Life Death is the other half of the Motendo episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do the Professor X and Life Death split. But I liked the Professor X side of that as well. That was pretty interesting.
It was a lot of deep thoughts about, you know, the way cultures treat other species and stuff like that, too. And how, you know, racism essentially was in there. And my wife was in the room, and she does not care for any of the stuff we like at all. Like, she doesn't watch any of the superhero crap. But she's in the room, she's playing on her iPad, and I watched that, again, Life Death Part 2. So you're getting the Storm stuff, and you get the Professor X stuff. And I noticed she was watching. She was not on her iPad. She was watching, and it got over and it ended, and she looked at me, she's like, "This is meant for kids?" And that, like, you know, yeah. I was like, that says a lot right there when you're like, no, okay, no, this yes, is not.
No, there's no, it's yeah. for people who were kids 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's probably exactly right. That was a very powerful episode. That's probably rates as my third favorite, yeah. that one.
Well, that's what's interesting, though, is that they've allowed the show to grow up with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, even though I wasn't there for it the first time, I feel I appreciate it now. And it does make me want to go back and investigate the original series a little more, I think. But I'll have to rewatch this first.
And I feel the same way. And like, I want to go back. So I tried a couple of the episodes of the original 97 series or 92 series, whatever, thinking, okay, I can get through it. Oh, they're still hard to stomach. Oh my gosh. And I didn't even start with season one, which is the worst. I started later and it was like, oh my gosh, this is so bad.
I think you may agree with this as well, that they should have stuck with the Pride of the X-Men animation style.
Pride of the X-Men is so stinking good. I have watched that. Yes. I bought it on VHS tape back in the day. I have watched that thing over and over and over. Like, we did a role-playing game a while back, and it was in the X-Men, set in the X-Men universe. And in the beginning, I'm like, all right, guys, here's how we're kicking it off. We're going to sit down and watch Pride of the X-Men. So I actually made my players watch Pride of the X-Men before we got started.
Nice. I remember buying the issue of Marvel Age where they previewed that.
Oh,
it was about 1988, something like that.
Probably, yeah.
I probably didn't see it until 2010. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
It was a long wait for that.
I saw it, I guess when it first came out, because it was never aired on TV. I guess I saw it the minute the videotape came out, and I just watched it over and over and over and over, and again, bought it and watched it over and over and over. Mm.
Yeah, it's great. Phenomenal. Beautiful looking cartoon. A little cheesy in the voiceover, but you know.
Shut up, you. So, watching five episodes last night, I did see something I didn't see the first time around when you watch it in a row like that. Really, a lot of the core of this, I mean, there's all kinds of stories going on, but one of the major cores of the story is Rogue. Mm. It is her heartbreak and her fury. Because there's this love triangle between her and Magneto and Gambit. After the fifth episode, she goes and attacks like military bases.
Phenomenal sequence that was.
Oh my God, it's so good. The action, it's like, yeah!
Between Rogue and Gladiator, you've got some of the best Superman action I've ever seen in a cartoon.
Right! I don't care if this spoils. She straight up kills Trask, or she tries to at least. You know, she almost kills Guy Ritchie. She has a argument with Captain America that's badass, and then her battle against Bastion, because she's so full of fury, is just powerful. So it really is a huge arc there for Rogue. And now everyone has an arc, but I mean, hers to me stood out.
Yeah, she turns away from the team in her fury and, you know, comes back. And yeah, she's at the heart of the series, certainly.
I think so, yeah. And then I think they developed Cable nicely. You know, Cable in a lot of people don't like Cable because they feel like he's too 90s. And I think Cable is a really, really cool idea, executed not very well. I liked him in the New Mutants issues, and I still will stand by him in the New Mutants issues where he comes in as the drill sergeant. I think that's great, actually. But beyond there, yeah, Cable becomes a mess. But I feel like they found ways to find really good emotional beats here where Scott and Jean realize who he is. And there's a great scene where they're fighting Sentinels, and Scott says, let's show them why, or something like, you know, let's show them that you don't mess with the Summers family or something like that. And it's just like, it's Cable and his dad just kicking ass. And you're like, yes!
This is the first time I've liked Cable.
Okay.
That says something that, they've even got me, a Cable skeptic, to go, yeah, okay, this guy's pretty cool.
Again, I think the ideas are there. It just wasn't executed. I mean, it was Rob Liefeld executing it, let's face it. And, you know, sorry, Rob, but you're not the world's best writer. And then it was the extreme 90s and a series of other people that came after him just desperately trying to capitalize on, you know, the cyborg guy.
Too many cyborgs with guns in the 90s. So he just fades into the background.
And then Nightcrawler gets a chance to shine in this series really, really well.
That sequence with him and Wolverine, their whole fight sequence. Oh.
Where he's got three swords?
Yeah,
that one?
Yeah.
Yeah!
And when you see the teleportation from his perspective as well.
Wow, that scene was crazy. Where Wolverine is like being pulled through the teleport. Yeah, he's like, he looks like he wants to puke.
I mean, talk about things you would never have been able to do in the 90s series. Just the level of animation creativity in that is just gorgeous. So.
And I'll credit X-Men 2, X-Men United, I think is what it was called, for really showing us what Nightcrawler can do in motion, if you will. But they keep it going here. His teleportation is just like, this is absolutely, I didn't even know it was this cool as a kid reading it. You know, it's just fantastic.
Agreed.
Yeah. And he's in the opening credits. He gets to Nightcrawler's in the opening credits. I mean, I freaking punch the air when he's in the opening credits.
And they change the credits every episode as well.
Yep.
So you get a little glimpse of what's coming up and how the lineup's changing and who is no longer alive.
If you have any doubts about trying the series, watch the opening credits of the 1990 series and remember how much you hate it. And then watch the opening credits for the 97 series, X-Men 97, because they recreate those same credits, but with the amazing animation. And you'll go, oh, okay. Oh, this works. If I had anything negative to say about the series, I'm not a big fan of Human Sentinels. For some reason, that type of storyline never appeals to me. They've done it with Daleks and Doctor Who, Human Daleks. I mean, I don't like, for whatever reason, when normal humans transform magically into the bad guy robot. And it's like, well, how does that work? I don't know. That doesn't sit well with me, but who cares? It made a great story gimmick. And Bastion, I did not go in expecting to like him, especially once we had chatted with our friends about how bad, I guess, the comic storyline was. I was like, uh-oh, I'm not going to like this. But yet, on screen, he was actually pretty cool.
Yeah, he's absolutely really compelling. So
yeah.
Yeah, the Human Sentinels, I'm fine with that. I mean, it's not an ideal thing to happen to you if you turn into one, but especially if you get hacked to pieces by Wolverine.
But apparently you can just put your pieces back together. I mean, these Human Sentinels were putting their own heads back on after they've been decapitated. I'm like, damn.
Yeah. Again, strong horror vibes through much of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Really interesting tone all over the place. So you got sort of the silly stuff with Motendo. You got horror in the Goblin Queen and the Sentinels. Then massive superhero battles and just some heavy themes. And yeah, some of it was hard to watch in a good way.
No, exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely phenomenal. Thank you for recommending it or insisting that I watch it.
Well, I absolutely love it. Now, the showrunner from season one is gone. I mean, there is some reasons behind that, I guess. I do worry without the showrunner if season two is going to be as strong. I hope so.
I believe he also wrote season two, but he won't be involved in season three. I think season two is already written. It's currently being animated, as far as I'm aware. But yeah, he has gone for season three. But he's still cheerleading the project. It's not like doesn't seem to be any bitterness from his perspective.
That's good. Okay, good.
So, yeah. And I would strongly recommend you watch on Disney Plus the behind the scenes making of, which is really interesting too.
I didn't know there was such a thing. Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, a lot of stuff about the voice actors in there that I think you'll really enjoy. So.
Ooh, I definitely want to check that out. All right. Awesome. Well, again, we didn't give as many spoilers as I thought, which is good. So folks, go watch X-Men 97. That's on Disney Plus. If you've gotten to hour 8 of this podcast now, then you're clearly an X-Men fan. So I think you will not be disappointed by this. And especially in like my brother, for example, let's just say my brother loves Marvel movies. He can't stand animation. He's like, he can't watch What If. And I think this is different. I especially if you liked X-Men at any point in your life. Wow. This is exactly what X-Men should have always been. I mean, I love Hugh Jackman in the role of Wolverine, but this was Chris Claremont's X-Men, come to life.
I mean, it's not only top tier MCU content, it's top tier X-Men content, like including the comics and all media. I think this is it's ranks alongside the finest X-Men stuff there's ever been, I'd say.
Yeah. And you're right. When you look at an MCU perspective, this is one of the best things they've done since Endgame. I'm not going to say it's the best because I have a lot of love for Hawkeye, but it's one of the best. Absolutely. So
yeah. Love it. Love it.
All right. So big picture, great set of comics. Thank you for suggesting we reread this. I loved diving back into the Australian Outback era and just sort of the scattered mess that it is. I love it for it. I love it even more the more we've had to sit down and really put my brain to it. So thank you for suggesting this.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. And yeah, I've really got to appreciate this story as a really pivotal story arc. As mentioned, it wasn't my favorite at the time, but yeah, this is central to a lot of stuff, to Inferno and the Genosha stuff that came later. Yeah, it's fantastic. So thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, and it's got me reading Extinction Agenda now, too. So thanks for that. I got better things to do with my time, but that's what I'm doing. So
I regret nothing, but I'm probably going to head off to Inferno and see how that goes.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
So folks, remember, go out to the comments, fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. I want to hear your thoughts on these X-Men stories, your favorite X-Men stories, all this stuff. Clearly, I have a lot to say about X-Men, so this will not be my final X-Men episode. I mean, it's not going to turn into an X-Men podcast, but I will have more X-Men episodes down the line. So thank you again, Matt, for sharing your love for the X-Men. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you?
So I used to run a comics blog called Ultron Is My Elvis. You can find the archived pages if you search for them, but I don't update it anymore. I basically hang around on Instagram under the name Satanic Matt. That's S-E-I, not S-A. And it's all just cats and handstands, so there's no problems.
do not downplay your astonishing handstands and weightlifting and yoga. I mean, dude, it's shocking. Like, I think my comic nerd self here, and I think of you and I sort of on the same field and a lot of our passions, then I look at what you can do physically. I'm like, oh, wow. Okay, never mind. Okay, this guy's a whole nother level of amazing.
Thank you. Hank McCoy taught me everything I know. So.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks again, Matt. This is, seriously, this has been so much fun. Now, folks, come back next time when we cover another topic that brings us joy. What will that topic be? Well, sorry, everyone. You're just going to have to find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Matt.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy.